we've closed business until after the election. Until Bola told me last Tuesday that other committees were proceeding with consideration of our annual report. And I immediately asked to inquire as to whether we can proceed with that. And the long and short of it. I discovered on Monday when I requested my secretary to confirm the availability of members for yesterday's meeting that there were only two members that were available. An exercise as important as this cannot be properly dealt with. Only by two members. So I thought that despite the inconvenience, it would only be appropriate that we shift things to today. It's like having a banquet without guests, and I didn't want the officials of any party. So my sincere apologies first to the department for any inconvenience and expense incurred, fruitless expense, now that I'm looking at the CFO. We take the blame for it as the portfolio committee, as well as the short notice due to the circumstances I've just explained. I'm not sure if we'll be able to deal with any other business this year. There are still outstanding reports. The oversight in Mpumalanga is raised issues that I'm sure members would have wanted to pursue. We've had a Brazilian experience. We still needed to reflect on that and adopt a report, etc. But we'll play it by the ear. Any other preliminary stuff before? Yes, Mary?
Sorry to interrupt, but yes. Could the members of the public have copies of the report?
Certainly, the reports are public documents. Are there copies? Yes, can somebody just assist? Because we're a little bit squashed around here. So,
Chair.
All right.
Yeah. Can somebody adjust the air conditioner? It's cold. It's a little hot inside.
Is it cold or hot?
Hot.
Oh, is it hot? I was born in Limpopo. So I'm not a Cape Tonian by origin. All right, I understand they've caused somebody to come in and assist. All right. I also just want to indicate that I am juggling myself between two tasks. I'm also attending, should I not take this off? I'm also attending an international AIDS conference at Goodhope Center. At which I was one of the respondents yesterday, which is looking at promoting access to treatment for persons infected by the virus. But I don't think that with the task at hand, I'd want to elope or abscond today. We met with Mr. Zane Dengo. Just remind me what your... I always call you the DG's right-hand man, but can you give me your correct title? Chief Operations Officer. Yesterday, to discuss the modalities of how we're going to proceed, and essentially left it to their good self to come up with a framework for the 2 days in terms of how we're going to approach things. It's my understanding that the arrangement or the agreement is that we won't deal with SASSA in these 2 days. That we would deal with SASSA next week. The ideal would have been to group social security issues together so that when we consider SASSA, we also consider the social security line function of the department at that stage. And we will deal with NDA. Initially, we're going to deal with them tomorrow. On Thursday morning. We have decided to expand Thursday to a full day and to actually have NDA in the afternoon and to have the line function in the department that deals with community development to immediately precede them so that there is a flow there because there is similarities in their time. But otherwise, the general arrangement was that I indicated clearly to the department that parties were not comfortable with the suggested approach of last year, that we should simply get a broad presentation from senior management, that parties would prefer to go into the specific line function, line function by line function, and engage with the relevant managers of those line functions. So that, because this exercise is not a briefing session, it's an oversight function. So as the portfolio committee, we use this opportunity to actually check things out. So it's not sufficient to get all the top brass here and giving us glossy stories. We want to hear it from the line function managers themselves. You know, how far are we with older persons? Is the Children's Act still being discussed as a possible thing for future implementation? Or are we seeing some kind of movement, etc.? All right, so I don't know what the department, but I said to Mr. Dengo that I will be soft on them if they don't have all their managers here. Because one, it's been short notice, there's been cancellations at short notice. We got to know very late that we can proceed in all those difficulties. And I hope fellow members will also indulge them in that manner. I don't know if there's any other preliminary business before I hand over to Mr. Dengo just to explain to us how we're going to proceed over the next 2 days. Any members who want to raise questions of clarity or other issues? All right. Mr. Dengo, please proceed. Lead us.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay. As you can see, we've got quite a big delegation here because the instruction was bring line management, not the five senior management people that would normally attend these meetings. So we've got enough people here to answer the questions. Based on our discussion, and because the 3 days were shortened into 2 days, but SASA will be beyond the 28th. And discussion with the chair yesterday, we changed the presentation. So instead of having one presentation and then question and answers, we're going to have today two presentations because what we need to be three presentations. And on that slide, part A essentially will deal with all the institutional capacity issues, the financial reports, the issues on human resources, the Auditor General's report, and within that, we also including issues that are important to the sector. So, for example, on the human resource issues, we will also include data on the occupational specific dispensation issues. We will then deal with all the presentations in that format where we take the key issues that we do as a department around policy, setting norms and standards, but also bringing into the discussion how these find expression through our service delivery agents, namely the provinces. We don't have all the data from the provinces, but I think we have enough data to engage with. So for today, what we're proposing is that we take part A, part B, and part C, which is the institutional capacity issues, the finance issues, the program performance issues as it pertains to comprehensive social security, and then also the program performance issues in relation to welfare services. Then tomorrow, which is day two, which is the community development day, as you indicated, Chair, we will have the community development presentation, but also then the presentation immediately from the MDA. So today we'll have three components, and tomorrow we'll have two components. So we may not need, today's going to be the longest day, actually. The first part of the presentation may go quicker, and then we can spend more time, I suppose, on the line function, on data. The presentations will be done, part A will be done by myself and the CFO. Part B, the comprehensive social security component, will be presented by Mr. Jaoma, who is the DDG for social security. And part C on welfare services will be presented by the DDG for welfare services, which is Dr. Mabetla. So, but there's also other staff members from those line functions who will assist them in answering the questions. So that's our proposal, Jim.
All right. Thank you. That's the proposed framework. Colleagues, would you want to react to that? Are you happy with that arrangement?
Yes.
All right. Can they proceed on along those lines?
Yeah.
If we need to make any interventions along the way to make some adjustments, we can always renegotiate the rules of the game. But please proceed on that basis then.
Thank you. So the first part I will deal with what we're calling the overview. And we will focus on the following key issues. Maybe I should just remind people about the 2007-2008 division missions and the strategic objectives that we had set for ourselves over that period, because it may guide the discussion. The vision was a caring and integrated system of social development services that facilitate human development and improve the quality of life. The mission was to ensure the provision of comprehensive, integrated, sustainable and quality social development services, to protect against vulnerability and poverty, and to create an enabling environment for sustainable development in partnership with those committed to building a caring society. Just very briefly, our strategic priorities for that period was to create an enabling environment for social and human capital investment, the promotion of social integration, social protection initiatives to build the capacity of vulnerable groups, to provide a comprehensive social security system, to exercise leadership in social development to ensure the deepening of the social policy discourse and evidence-based decision-making, effective and efficient management of social development programs and activities in partnership with civil society and other partners, steer national involvement in African and international frameworks, and agreements with respect to socioeconomic development, and all of this underpinned by good governance. So, part A will then deal with issues of administration. The program objectives will be presented when the line function managers do their specific presentation. So I'm going to go through this and move directly into the functional areas under this area. The first component that I'm going to focus on is on human resource management. Now, we've also indicated, included data going back to 2004-2005 to give members a sense of how our human resource management has managed issues of vacancies over the last few years. Now, if I look at the number of posts in 2004-2005, one will see there was 596. And then the number of posts filled is 403. So our vacancy rate at that period was 32.4%. In 2005-2006, we see that the establishment grew.
Yeah, we've totally lost. Yeah. Okay. We want to find where we are now.
On the side.
Yeah.
Is there some difficulty?
Yeah.
I'm still having a small print version, so it's not accessible to me at all. I'm hoping that somebody will do a larger font.
Yeah.
Are we finding ourselves? As long as we're able to follow on the screen, are we able to?
Are you on the wrong page?
Yeah.
Need another one like this. Okay.
Yeah. We are on this page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is everybody on the same wavelength?
No.
All right. Can we proceed?
Need a document like this. Sorry, you can't listen.
Yeah.
Need another document like this.
We didn't need that document.
But the one I'm having is different to this one.
Yeah.
Are we having different documentation?
Yeah.
That one.
Is that the correct document?
This one. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
On the same page now.
Are we now on the same wavelength?
Yes.
All right.
Proceed.
Okay, please proceed. Thank you, Jim. As I was saying, that in 2005-2006, the establishment of the department grew, so the number of posts was 613, the number of posts filled was 463, the vacancy rate was then 24.5%. In 2006 and 2007, the vacancy rate was 21.8%. 2007-2008, the establishment grew to 687, with the number of posts being filled being 534. So, in essence, the vacancy rate there was 22.3%. And as of the 31st of the 12th or 8th, it's standing at 10%. So there's been a gradual decrease in the vacancy rate, also at the same time, a significant growth in the establishment of the department. So the number of posts have increased, but also our ability to focus posts, especially over the last 2 years, has improved significantly. Also, the number of posts that are filled additional to the establishment has also sort of decreased after 2004 and then leveled off. These are posts that are not part of the official structure, but essentially posts that are deemed important as key issues emerge within a particular period of time. I think the current vacancy rate is at 10% in June, but you can give more information on that. Okay. This is essentially just how does one understand this phenomenon? Is it a matter of decasualization in the sense of making people more permanent, or is it a question of basically eliminating positions that are not of a permanent nature?
At the base. Push the. There's a button pushed on the base.
Okay, thank you. Chairperson, it's a combination of factors. The contract appointments.
Mics, because they seem to be in
Thank you, Chair. It's a combination of factors. First of all, the fixed-term contracts, which are currently 49, are essentially, the purpose is essentially for a special project undertaken in a number of areas in the department. It ranges from line function posts or positions to support positions. That is to deal with a temporary increase in work in a number of areas. The growth of the permanent posts over the since 2004-05 to date was informed by service delivery needs of the department and to execute the mandate of the department. There's a number of areas where we were undercapacitated, and the purpose was to gradually increase the capacity so that the department can achieve its strategic objectives. Proceed.
Thanks. Just important to point that the period under review 2007-2008, in the annual report, we had put the vacancy rate at 22.3% because we were dealing with a particular financial year. Even though appointments were made before the 31st of March, people only assumed duty after the 31st of March. So the actual vacancy rate was 13.2%. But because of the time frame that we were dealing with, we had to reflect it as 22.3%. Do you want me to go through the employment in the categories as well? Because it just explains the slide that I've dealt with in a bit more detail.
I think that at some point we'll obviously be interested to hear how the department is faring in terms of national policy imperatives around human resource policy. For example, issues of gender, disability, issues of inclusion, more broadly in terms of policies to accommodate of diversity, issues of promoting youth employment and those kind of issues. I'm hoping that in the course we're not just going to get raw data, but we're going to get a sense of whether national policies are being absorbed and actually internalized within your system as well.
Sure.
Whichever way you can bring that across.
Sure. In perhaps after the presentation and the question and discussion session, we can actually speak to some of those issues as well.
All right.
Okay, this slide essentially just is a narrative of that presentation I've given on the vacancy rate numbers. Essentially, just to summarize it, we fill 83% of our prioritized posts. We've reduced the vacancy rate to 14%, which is now standing at 10%. So it's essentially just a summary of the key issues that we've dealt with now. So I'm going to move on to the next slide, which is going to deal with the issues of supply chain management. There's been the questions that were sent to us from the portfolio committee researchers did ask a specific question around the issue of supply chain management. So we'll talk a bit about that, and the CFO will give more information if needs be. But the department implemented a new supply chain management directive in line with the needs and directives by Treasury. We established the following committees, a bid specification committee, a bid evaluation committee, and a bid adjudication committee in August 2007. So those are the key governance issues and instruments around supply chain management that were put in place. We completed asset management policies and strategies in consultation with the department stakeholders. Total procurement spending for the period under review was 157,953.7, given take a few cents there. The total procurement was divided as follows: for historically disadvantaged individuals, 53 million.
I don't have that.
You don't have that slide?
That is fine.
Oh, okay. The vacancy rate, the vacancy, the share of our procurement spend to HDI was 38.6% to women empowerment, which is what the WEO stands for. The share of our procurement spend was 28%. Non-HDI was 25%, and other institutions was 7.6%. So, in total, the
amount
of
WEO.
Women's equity ownership.
Women's equity ownership.
Yeah.
In South Africa. Well, it's acronym. Yes, Ms. Temple.
Yeah, just if you've got HDI, the women, and the non-HDI, what's the other institutions? What can be possibly left out or can go through those three?
Either, yeah. The non, what you call other institutions, there is a lot of work done by entities like, for instance, state organs or, let's say, public institutions where you can't look at ownership in terms of shareholding, like your Human Science Research Council and those kind of universities, etc. I don't have the slide in an accessible form, so I'll try and catch on as you proceed. All right, please proceed. Thanks. You'll need to explain more because I'm not seeing anything.
Yes. Do we have a specific budget for this item? Is it over, was it overspend or not?
All right.
On this issue.
Look. Also, in terms of the finance issues, I assume that we're going to get a full presentation on the financial side. So, but I'll allow the question.
Do we have to answer that question now, or do you want to wait for
There was no overspending. In fact, what is part of this is these are consulting fees mainly, because you spend on mainly when you do research work and other related procurement, for instance, when we buy furniture, etc. There's a lot of things, services and goods. So if you look at under goods and services, when you come to the financial report, you'll see that there is a saving that we reported there under goods and services. I just wanted also to mention that this should be useful for the committee. There is a limit of 500,000 in the department that we can actually procure in terms of quotation. Beyond that, we must go for tender. Now, it's not in the slide, but our target for the bids actually was a split of 50-30. 50% for HDI, 30% for women equity ownership. Now, just for that, well, if you exclude the quotation ones, the actual achievement, we actually have 65.89% on HDI and 39.87% on women equity, just on the bids that are about 500,000. The total of that is 74.8 million of the 137. So on that side, I think we did quite well.
All right, you're happy?
Yeah.
Mr. Skipper? All right. Please proceed.
Thanks, Chair. We'll also, probably revisit some of these things when we do the financial sections of the report. Under the institutional capacity component of our report, we've also included our international obligations. It was part of our strategic thrust over the period under review. This component of our work has grown considerably since 1994. Leading to increased bilateral and multilateral interactions. The department's focus in the international arena is on the development of solid long-term partnerships with developing countries. The areas of focus in our international engagement are around the following issues: the rebuilding of family and community relations, a comprehensive social security system, and that is about sharing knowledge and experiences, around the approach that we've taken with other countries, eradicating violence against women and children, older persons, and other vulnerable groups, and also the fight against HIV and AIDS and dealing with the social impact of the disease, particularly in developing countries. So in line with how...
That stopped the question there. I'm just surprised with the emphasis we've had on substance abuse, but that's not one of the key focus areas. I'd just like to ask why.
I also just want to find out why are we putting emphasis only on this matter as international obligation and not at the same time as, for example, constitutional imperatives in terms of our own domestic obligations. I would have thought that we satisfy our own constitution first before we satisfy everybody else out there. But maybe there's a context to it.
Context in terms of when we're presenting this. I mean, obviously some of the line functions, both at national and provincial level, but also the NGOs that we work with deal with all of these issues. So the bulk of our work internally is about rebuilding of family and community relations. The social security system, obviously, which we'll have a discussion on that later. Our focus internally is significantly around the protection of women and children and vulnerable groups. We've also got a component on HIV/AIDS and the whole chief directive that deals with that internally. But we've also had to, as much as we struggle internally with dealing with these issues, the department has been engaged with countries in the region around these similar issues, not to the scale that we're dealing with them internally. It's more about sharing of information, sharing of experiences. And in some cases, like in the Congo, it's really about developing policy or strategy where there's nothing that exists. And to the extent of institutional building, even though we haven't perfected our own institutions, the kind of institutional gaps that you find in some of the other areas means that there is an area of partnership that we can engage with some of our neighboring countries. So it's not to the extent of our internal work, but it's definitely a focus. On the issue of substance abuse, it's really in many of these areas, for example, we are guided by what we can really share meaningfully with our partners. I think that our own approach to substance abuse is developing and growing. And the kind of partnerships around in that area is something that we will probably have to pursue over the coming years, particularly given the cross-border nature of the distribution of substance abuse issues.
Let's not go into that. I mean, we obviously have the line function here to engage them directly in terms of, we just passed the bill last year. So a lot of issues are still fresh in our minds. But just before I allow further discussion here, just to clarify, the context of the intervention was one that says that our understanding would be that the department would right up front say, these are our national obligations and our national priorities, first and foremost, and then proceed to say, among those national priorities, some of them are further informed by certain international obligations, and not the other way around, not start with what the rest of the world expects us to do. You saw Obama focus very much on the domestic situation in America first, before he deals with the rest of us. So, that is the context in which the intervention was made. And when the additional issue of substance abuse came, it was invited by exactly that concern that we seem to be starting from the outside instead of starting from the inside. I don't know how you're going to whether there is a slide that's going to take us through our national priorities at some point. But that would have been the preferred sequence.
Yes, Jay, coming back to international obligations, on page 5 of the executive summary, there is mention of a lot of countries in the southern hemisphere that we, Africa, that we work with. But I don't see that Zimbabwe is mentioned in this line. And I wonder why, because we know what the status of all the things in Zimbabwe is. Thank you.
But let them first just clarify the issue of national priorities first, and then we will get to. We have basically interrupted them on a presentation on international relations. So, because we're feeling that we must start at home first and clarify the home front situation, and then we can clarify the international situation. So let them first pass through the snag, and then they'll come to back to the issue, to flow with the issues of internet, including your question.
Right. It's a question, it's basically an issue of sequencing in our presentation.
All right.
That we thought we deal with the issues of institutional capacity, sort of the issue that a non-line function managed in the early part of the presentation, and international relations is one of those issues. Now, we could have done it differently where we integrate the international relations component with what happens in line functions, but we needed to separate the international relations work. So it's the
all right, we'll hold our horses.
Yeah.
But remember, you have an unpaid account there. So at some point, it will have to be settled. And I still believe that it would have to be settled in the context of this session, of this leg of the presentation, because I don't see line function managers accounting for the department as to what its national priorities are. I see senior management doing that. All right. That will allow you to flow according to how you're prepared for now.
Thanks, Jeff.
Okay, so towards the understanding that substance abuse from international perspective, or what do you call this, international obligations, it's at this stage not listed as one of the priority areas in this area. Is that the understanding? Because I know that we have had a report from, what do they call that, UN organization? That suggests that our problem is growing, and we ourselves in the substance abuse context of the substance abuse bill, we highlighted the fact that the department has not put as much capacity, resources, etc., in this area to match the growing nature of that specific challenge. So I hope you are not by default actually vindicating our criticism of the department in that regard by not having highlighted it in this section as such.
I will do the section on health services. There's a component that's going to deal with substance abuse, and within that we can also discuss our partnerships with UNODC that looks at our problem in context of what's happening in other parts of the world as well. So we can have that discussion there. I think what we're just talking about is a small component of the department's work around international relations.
And the specific things that it has focused on as much. All right. Okay. Give that the context.
Yeah.
Okay. Proceed.
So what I plan to do is go through this section a little faster so that we can get to the finance sections and then move to the substantive part around social security later on.
All right.
So just quickly, so in line with our international obligations, these are some of the meetings that we've listed. You know, there's a lot of our meetings also deal with the fact that the minister chairs a component of UNESCO, which is called MOST, and that is a forum that brings together social development ministers from across the world, and it's a forum that he chairs, and it's about facilitating alignment, particularly in developing countries around issues of policy and strategy on issues of broad social development, including issues of the health components of social development. So that's where a lot of our support goes to, and it's been quite useful in the sense of bringing together ministers and officials of social development in East Africa, West Africa, Southern Africa, where we begin to share experiences and also begin to discuss key policies that are of significance to the region. Now, the issue of Zimbabwe was raised, and in fact, given the situation in Zimbabwe, we are not even at the stage to engage on rebuilding. For example, when we engaged with the Congo, it's when there was a level of agreement on what's the way forward and a transition, and then we could step in. The space to do that in Zimbabwe hasn't been there up to now. So there's no agreement to follow there.
Well, we cannot be a lead department in that situation.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
All right. So, Jay, I'm going to go through many of these, just some of the details. You know, if there are questions on the international relations areas, the slides are there and we can engage more with it. But I'd like to move on to the finances component.
I've been fairly flexible in terms of allowing points of exigency, if you like. But the general approach is that we allow the presentation to finish and then we can engage in our areas of interest. Members would also be aware that we asked the research unit to put together a set of questions to the department. I don't know if there's actual written responses as such or whether you'll deal with that in the context of the respective areas of presentation where those questions apply. But yeah, that's just to assist us. Ultimately, it really depends on where the members themselves want to put emphasis in the questions. Yeah.
We have prepared responses to all of those questions. Some of them we've integrated into the presentation. If not, then we will also deal with them as questions are asked on them if we haven't covered them.
All
right. Chair, at this stage, I'd like to hand over to the CFO to do the finances.
Thanks, Chair, and members of meeting colleagues. May I say good morning. My name is Kota Kopagati, I'm the CFO. I am not going to be long, but I want to just contextualize two issues relating to the expenditure for the 7-8 financial year. But before I go there, I want to mention that the department has been accelerating its intervention in terms of financial management improvement. This has actually been, resulted in once more an unqualified audit report by the Auditor General. We also seen, especially now in 7-8, a reduction in the number of issues raised by the Auditor General, the so-called housekeeping issues, that is, issues relating to internal control weaknesses. There has been quite a significant improvement in the department when it comes to that, and that has been acknowledged by the Audit Committee as well. However, I will come back to the emphasis of matter, which is one issue that was raised by the Auditor General, which largely relate to the process of the function shift and the establishment of SASA. And I will just give you an update of where we are in addressing that issue. But for now, I will just focus on the expenditure because it links to performance in terms of the output also that we achieved by the various programs. Chair, as you know, the bulk of our budget is transfers to households for social grants. It is a very complex process to forecast and try to project exactly what you need and how much you will spend for that in any given financial year, simply because we are in a transition. We have been gradually changing policies, extending the child support grant. Now we are going to start in January to go to 15 years. we also have been equalizing the age difference between men and women. All those things need accurate estimates. I must say, since we took over from provinces, the projections have improved significantly.
You have been shifting policy on the means test as well. Right?
And the means test as well. So all those permutations, I mean, taken into account, it makes it a very complex process to know exactly how much you will need in terms of paying out the to actual beneficiaries. Hence, provinces have been overspending over years. And in the year that we took over, remember, we saved about $1 billion through other efforts of campaigning and the minister's intervention in the fraud strategy, etc. But for the first time, we almost spent up to the estimated amount or budgeted amount on social assistance, which indicates how we have improved in terms of understanding how to project an estimated forecast for social assistance. But I'll come back to that again when I deal with the slides dealing with social grant expenditure. So all in all, Chair, we managed to spend 67.1 billion out of an allocated budget of 67.2 billion, which is 99.9% overall, if you include transfers, etc., which is indeed a very good indication. So if you look at the next slide there, where it looks at the audited outcome, which is actually audited expenditure per program, it then gives you a breakdown of how much we spend in each program. Administration was 99.8, comprehensive social security 100.04. That is where I'll come back and explain that overspending in that program, which is about 24.1 million, which basically relates to social grants. Policy development review implementation of support for welfare services, it was 84.55. Community development, 93.67. Strategy and governance, 77.29. Now, if you look at that and look at the economic classification, again, it shows that, as I indicated, the most expenditure was on transfers and subsidies, which is largely the social grants, which were 100.04, goods and services, 84 for compensation of employees and payment of capital of 70. Now, if you then, Chair, take out the transfers and look at the operational budget of the department, there is that next slide. The pie chart is just showing the breakdown of the budget in terms of different components on the operational expenditure. The next slide then speaks to that. The lower spending there was program pay, which was at 68.36%. And then I will come back to give the reasons for underspending. And I think that will also maybe come out when the individual line function programs present to say what has been achieved and what has been rolled over to the new year or deferred to the new year for finalization. And then community development next was at 69.85%. And the largest spending programs was Program 1 and 2, which is administration and comprehensive social security. Administration, obviously, is more corporate services, the ministry, deputy ministry, communication, legal services, finance, HR, all those programs, they fall under that program, administration. Then the next slide just shows the breakdown, the economic classification, which again shows how much we've spent. As you will see, Mr. Van Vieren indicated that there was additional posts that had to be filled in 7-8. I think the establishment significantly increased to 6 something. And we managed to fill up to 507 posts, 580 something like that. But I think that is going to change in this current financial year because most of those posts then were filled, and it will show in the actual expenditure that we are no longer having a space for underspending on compensation of employees. Goods and services, transfers, payment of capital assets, I must say the budget for capital assets as well is not much, because it's basically your furniture and equipment that we're referring to there. And also it links to the growing establishment. So we have to buy new furniture for new people that are employed and new computers for them. But again, that expenditure is going to also increase this year, because as we have filled those posts, there won't be much saving on the capital expenditure. Well, if I go on the overall reason for underspending, I think we call it here delays in the filling of posts. But I think if you look at it, it's really the newly created posts, and there are processes that unfortunately we have to follow in terms of job evaluating those posts, advertising, and so on. And those processes take a little bit long. It's better when you fill an existing post where you don't need to go and start afresh and do a job evaluation. So as we have restructured the department now, and we more or less, I don't want to use the word right size, but we really structured the department to be in line with its mandate, there isn't going to be much delays in filling posts. I can promise that. But that was the main reason. Obviously, if you don't have the people, then also your expenditure on goods and services, your expenditure on capital also will be lesser, because people are not yet there to do the operations. So the next slide just gives the breakdown that I indicated earlier on what is entailed under Program 1. I don't think I need to spend the time there, but you can see the amount that was budgeted, the amount that was spent, and the percentage spending on each of those categories under Program 1. And I think Program 1 spent almost 99.8%, so it's not really a problem. Program 2, and again, Program 2 spent 94.17%, which is really within acceptable standards. And that's a breakdown of some of the sub-programs within the social assistance, social insurance, policy implementation support, and then also contributions and affiliations to certain organizations. There isn't much understanding there, but we have a reason that we gave under goods and services. There was a tender that was awarded for piloting the care dependency assessment tool, which was amounting to 1.5 million. This tender was awarded in December 2007, and an amount of 500 was paid during March for the initial phase of the project. So the balance then was to be incurred in the new financial year. Well, on Program 3, spending there is a little bit low, which is the core services under welfare. Welfare service transformation, children, families and victims, HIV and AIDS contributions administration. And the main reasons for this underspending relates to delayed projects. That is the delay in the execution of certain projects. And I've listed those projects there. It is the costing of the comprehensive policy on disability, the rollout of second phase of the norms and standard projects for social welfare services, the establishment of the clearing house for the CDA meaning the Central Drug Authority, the research on substance abuse impact, the training of the chemo manuals, and the auditing of old age facilities. Well, I will ask the relevant line managers to give the detail in terms of what were the reasons maybe for each of these projects, what caused the delays, etc. But there were unforeseen challenges that were experienced, especially with regard to the capacity of that unit to run all these projects. What we are doing, I must say that upfront, Chair, that as a department, we consistently try to put up measures, processes to ensure that these kind of delays are not experienced in the future. One of the things we said we will be doing this year is that before April, we will have all the spending plans and all the procurement plans submitted to the supply chain unit. They must be assessed and approved by management, and then come the new financial year, we must start spending. We must start getting the necessary people to do the work on board. So that what we picked up is that some of these things where you have a lag between planning and actual implementation, it does cause a lot of delays, because the government requirements in terms of procurement, we won't change those, but we must try to find a way of ensuring that those requirements will still be fulfilled, but we start early. We must start early to plan and implement our projects. In terms of community development, we spend overall at 68.95%. And some of the reasons there for this an understanding was the delay in the implementation of projects, again, especially media campaigns for NPOs and NGOs within the community, the costing of the impact assessment of technical reference team on the registration and capacity building of NPOs, and the registration of the national qualification for community development workers. In the last program, which is strategy and governance, this is a program that deals with monitoring and evaluation, entity oversight, the special project coordination like your EPWP programs, your social policy coordination, population research. The slight understanding there was on strategy development, entity oversight, as well as administration. But the other programs fairly 100%, other sub-programs 93.44%, like your social policy coordination, and then you also spent above 90% of their budget. So the main delays there were on the, because of the new appeal tribunal that we are developing, there was time spent on conceptualization of this entity and organizational design, which necessitated that we do a little bit of research, consultation with provinces and other stakeholders. So that also took time in terms of getting ready to roll out this work around the establishment of the tribunal. But the line function will also give a little bit more detail if there is any questions. And also the implementation of the management information system for social development. Again, it's a big project that we are implementing in partnership with CETA, and there are also a lot of what they call concept development work that needs to be done around there. And this MIS project now is, in fact, ready for rollout. In fact, by the end of the financial year, we had a lot of commitment already that we still need to pay. So there's going to be significant expenditure around the IT-related projects in this current financial year. So I don't move now to transfers. I'll start with SASA transfers, which is social assistance. As I indicated, we spent the full amount, a slight excess of 0.15%. This actually translate to 26.168 million rand that was overspent. The reason for this overspending, as I indicated earlier on, we should not have overspent in this area, I must say upfront, because there was an amount of 99 million which related to two invoices that were not paid for the Eastern Cape for the year-end 6-7. We actually picked up those invoices that they were not paid. So in our forecast for the new year, we told Treasury that we didn't take into account that. So we'll have a shortfall. So we applied for the rollover on the amount that was saved in 6-7 financial year for that 99 million. Unfortunately, that rollover was not approved by Treasury. So effectively, that overspending wouldn't have been there if we did get that rollover, because the money that we forecasted or we projected to spend in 7-8 would have been within our means. So, and the reason also that even if we did get that 99 million and we didn't overspend, we would be very close to have spent what we actually budgeted for. And again, the work that we have done in improving the financial management and forecasting tool helped us to ensure that we are able to project accurately for social assistance. Any deviation of within 50 million for a total budget of about 70 billion is commendable. Throughout the world, it's not an easy thing to forecast. To forecast for social assistance expenditure, but I think as a country we are improving significantly, working very closely with SASSA. I think they're doing a good job there as well.
I didn't pick it as a result of Treasury declining a request. What became Plan B? How
are you going to resolve it? Well, let me say this way. Treasury understands the implication, the complication or the complexity of focusing for social assistance. Even this year is the same thing. When we went to the adjustment estimates, we asked for more money in order to address the means test adjustment, the age equalization, etc. But Treasury said no, rather we will try to see if we can look at what they call special appropriation, if need be, just before the end of the financial year. They're always reluctant to give us more money because they always believe that these are estimates. So what they asked them was, use the new budget. Let's see if the new budget will be adequate or not. You know, the problem with that approach is that if you go through the adjustment estimates, beyond that, there's very little chance to do the adjustments. And looking at 26 million overspending, it could have been either way. It could have been less or more than 26 million. So they were reluctant to go to Parliament for special appropriation for something that may or may not happen. That's how difficult it is to project for
social assistance. I'm trying to understand is where the legal obligations arising from that oversight that resulted in an obligation not being met, and if Treasury is not prepared to assist you in honoring that legal obligation, that is, if it is, what is your alternative in terms of responding to, and how imminent was that legal obligation? Maybe you can just clarify what the context of that.
As I said, Chair, as of March, it was already due and payable. So we had to pay in April out of the new allocation. The ultimate result is that you use your new budget of the new year to pay for old debts. That's basically what it means. Unfortunately, those debts we have to pay because, as you say,
they have in fact been paid.
They have been paid, yes. They were paid in April.
Okay.
Thanks, Chairperson. Then for the administration budget, FASA will explain this in more detail next week. But we had 4.1 billion that was budgeted, and they spent 4.5 billion, so they overspent by 0.86%. They have given us a long letter explaining what resulted in the overspending. Much of the reasons given, we understand, and we even Treasury has sympathy with them, because as they are continuously establishing, especially capacitating the regions, the costs, especially costs relating to construction as well as leasing commitments for space and office accommodation is escalating, and some of these were unforeseen. So also the organizational structure in some instances had to grow because of service delivery demands. So SASSA also inherited certain contracts, especially on the IT, that were already approved before they were established in the process of ensuring that there will be a smooth process of establishing the organization. For instance, the enterprise resource system, which basically is a system that needs to be there for them to be able to manage their day-to-day operations. Also, there were also contracts relating to fraud management, which they had to take over. So all those IT contracts, the bulk of which have cost escalation in terms of licenses and other things. So Kenya and SAPA are in the process of engaging to look at what is the appropriate budget that should be given to SAPA. In fact, there will be some significant increase that will be allocated to SAPA only in the new financial year. As we know, there has been significant tight strings now because of the financial crisis that is sweeping the world. But there is recognition that we need to do something for SAPA. So that was a slight, but there are measures also, they will speak to this next week, that they are putting in place to try and contain their spending and try to be within the limit of the little amount that they have. Mm-hmm. Difficult as it may be, Chair, but I think they have to do that belt tightening exercise.
Can I just say that, you know, at some point we may need to get more information about, because there is the practical thing of understanding overspending, but there is a strategic question of the overall sustainability of a program and the political discourses that then flow out of that. You know that there has been all kinds of comments around the social security system promoting dependency, becoming being at risk of eventually becoming unsustainable as it expands, mm-hmm. And those kind of issues. So I suppose maybe when we get to comprehensive social security, we'll be addressed on that.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
Absolutely. Jehoma is already anxious to come in, but hold on. Yeah, so on the NDA, NDA was allocated 129 million, and of that, they allocated 85.6% on grant expenditure. Again, we didn't give detail here because NDA will present quite elaborately on this tomorrow on the financial results, etc. I must just mention that they have been also trying to get more money from the fiscus in order to assist them in expanding their services, especially their new strategy that focus on capacity building of CSO, civil society organization. They haven't been successful, but we are still engaging with them to try and see how best can we address the issue of financial constraints that they have. But the CEO might just touch on those things tomorrow. With regard to disaster relief, we received 10 million for disaster relief, Chairperson, in 7-8, which was...
Before you proceed, NDA is linked to community development. Is there a way in which we can understand the relationship? Well, let me put it this way. The disbursements that NDA is able to make is what really drives community development in a sense, because that's where the projects out there get actually funded. That community development wing do something similar or actual disbursement, or it's merely policy development and monitoring, including the monitoring of the NDA itself? Is it simply there to be the oversight of the NDA? In other words, I'm trying to understand when we talk of NDA struggling to get its budget enlarged, in a sense, does that translate into our whole community development strategy, which is intended to promote sustainable livelihoods, in a sense being constrained, and in other words, us not being able to significantly, you know, make headway in terms of this whole shift from dependency to empowering people to become economically sustainable.
Then we'll try and answer that, Chair. Maybe I'll add if there's anything there.
We've also got some people from Community Development Land Function there that we can expand on that, but obviously we'll have a more in-depth discussion tomorrow. But essentially, Chair, the bulk of community development's budget is for the NDA. Once the transfer to the NDA has been made, you left with a very small slice at the national office to do policy work or to begin to develop concepts and approaches to community development across government. You know, I think it was not 2006-07, but last financial year, there's apparently 20 billion rand within the system looking at community development, but that's across government. So there's no coordinated approach to how we look at community development, whether it's the built environment, whether it's housing, whether it's a number of community development initiatives. So what we use, the small money that we do get at national is to begin to look at what does sustainable livelihoods mean, how do you actually develop a comprehensive program around that. And our engagement with the NDA, it's about how do you fund according to these kind of priorities. So the NDA is essentially the key driver of community development in the social development sector, but it's a small sliver of the actual money available for community development in government. In fact, it's, if you look at the budget that we get for community development versus the kind of money you get in DPLG, housing, this is actually meaningless in many ways.
You see the context in which I know that it's more a strategic issue than a finance issue, but part of the exercise here is not just to look at numbers. Is to ask whether the numbers relate to the policy priority. If you're saying that you want to shift people out of social security, social assistance, and dependency, and move them, graduate them into sustainable livelihoods, and if the main tool to achieve that is community development, for example. I don't know, maybe there are other tools, you'll educate me. But if this is the main tool that you're going to achieve that strategic policy goal, and yet when it comes to the numbers, there doesn't appear to be any shift, effectively, what are we saying? And how should we approach this issue in terms of our oversight function as Parliament? Because remember, our constitutional task is to monitor the actual implementation of government policy so that we don't hear one thing, but we see another, all right? So when it comes to some of these sticky issues, we're not just going to let you pass or gloss over them. We're going to want to hear more. So it's both a numbers, it's a strategic question of the numbers talking to the policy priorities so that we as politicians are then able, then we know what's cut for us, what we need to be advocating for. And that is to say we've committed ourselves at the level of policy, but the numbers are not yet reflecting significantly those policy shifts that we've committed ourselves to.
That question is an extremely important one to take forward. And it goes beyond sort of looking at one strategic objective of the department in relation to another. So the strategic objectives of social security, which is meeting constitutional obligations in relation to meeting the needs of poor people who do not have the means, is very different from the strategic engagement around community development, which is essentially about building civil society, building self-reliance versus the issue of dependence. And there's a very significant difference between the two. I think what the approach that we've taken is that there's enough indications showing that the transfers, the cash transfers to households actually improve self-reliance versus creating dependency. In the sense that people are more like, I mean, the research, and we can talk about that when we do social security. The community development component
when it's seen as an off-ramping exercise, actually does disservice to community development, because they will never be able to do that. If one looks at, if you're spending $70 billion on grants of various types, and eventually the demand for that will decrease only if other spheres, big macro spheres like the jobs environment, comes to the fore. A small budget on community development is never going to create enough jobs. And in fact, we get caught up in that. It's almost a false argument that we've been engaging with, and I think we've been really honest with ourselves, is that there's no way that we're going to make a dent, even with $156 million we give to the NDA. You need to have policy issues that creates more jobs, decent jobs, all of these kind of issues, which over time will reduce the demand for grants. Community development is about building civil society, getting people involved in civic engagement, and we're actually questioning whether we should be getting involved in economic projects, because there's global research that shows that project approaches don't necessarily work. DTI and other government departments have done a scan on the cooperatives policy. On
the macro structural issue, rather than, But I'm sure Mr. Jehovah, when he tells us about his comprehensive social security, he'll draw the synergies for us in terms of the economic strategic issues and how they relate, all those discourses there. All right, but I take your point. I'm just throwing it out there and see whether there's anything All right.
We can take it further here tomorrow, because I know we had engagement even. I thought Ben would mention that. We had a workshop last year with provinces and NDA where we engaged on this specific issue, looking at the community development strategy. There were some research findings that we also presented there that we're looking at what provinces are doing, because you also touched on project funding. Yes, because the provinces are currently funding a range of projects, and that report is actually critiquing that in terms of what we're doing in line with what you're saying. Is it the right strategy? Should we be involved in these economic interventions, etc.? But tomorrow, I'm sure we'll share a lot of more information with you.
We'll reach the NDA of trusted preparations as well. All right.
We also had funding here at National, which is usually cited 10 million rand, which we give to Disaster Relief Board. I hope Mr. Chaoma and the team will speak more to this. This 10 million rand essentially is for us to come in when there are certain disasters that are declared in the country. Over time, there has been a review of these institutions and the way in which we relate to this specific program. Given that there's a new Disaster Management Act, there's a role now, more role specifically played by DPLG, and what role should social development still play in this issue? The whole different funds that we have, I think we have got about four funds that we manage in the department, or we administer in different boards, the disaster relief, the social relief, the refugee relief, and the state president fund. So we're looking at the legislation that will, kind of consolidate this whole thing into one, maybe social relief fund, and maybe do away with the boards. So given that, we had in this current financial year 8-9 kind of rendered this board to be, what's the term I should use? But there is a whole review process that's going on. But we transferred that 10 million. In future, we're going to tell you exactly what has been the decision around it. The amount spent on that is not much. Unfortunately, I see in this specific presentation, they didn't indicate how much was spent on the disaster relief. But we have a cumulative balance, I think now, of all combined funds of about 90 million, which we are busy negotiating even with Treasury in terms of how we move on with those funds. So those funds are sitting there now currently.
Another strategic issue that arises here that's not only limited to the board and the fund is the issue of we need at some point to do an audit of outstanding legislative and policy reform areas. We've been celebrating the big story of the New Children's Act and patting ourselves on the backs and the older persons and the whatever else, but the reality is that there are perhaps even key areas of legislative and policy reform which for which there's still some backlog, and I'm not sure whether there is a clear plan and a clear audit of what those areas are. So that, because remember, this last year as Parliament, and therefore it's time to reflect on how have we fared in terms of the key areas that need it, especially given the fact that the legislative function is one of our key constitutional functions. How have we fared in terms of discharging that constitutional responsibility? But I'm just flagging it. I'm not expecting you to deal with it at this stage.
The noted chair, the comment is very valid. The last two transfers that we have, the one is on social relief. This is a 5 million that annually we get for the department to come in and assist when there is kind of disasters that are not yet declared. Whilst we are waiting for those processes, there is emergency need for us to give material support and other support to families or individuals that are affected or displaced. So that money was spent, 4.752 million was spent in that financial year. And lastly, we have national councils, which are listed on the last slide, of how much we spend. The money that we transferred to national councils are as indicated, to 7.468%. In closing, Chair, then I want to come back to the issue that I mentioned.
I just want to add there that the national councils, as far as I recall, are regulated by the National Welfare Act, a chunk of which has become defunct. So, again, we're dealing with a case legislation that's patchwork or something. I'm not aware of a revised legislative framework that regulates the national councils, other than the fact that they're recognized under that particular fragmented law. So I'm just illustrating the earlier point that I was making, that there are areas of legislative reform which are behind. Social relief of distress can also be mentioned, and I'm sure you'll be telling us about progress in developing a new legal framework there. But all right, enough of interjections and interruptions. Please proceed.
Then on the comment, or rather opinion expressed by the Auditor General, there was an issue which, in fact, is not a new issue. We on the transfer of the function from province to national, the social assistance function, we had to transfer assets and liabilities as well. In 6-7, you'll recall that most of the balances we did not disclose in the financials because we could not consolidate them, except just to report on the expenditure on social assistance. So in 7-8, we consolidated most of those balances, except for the debtors. Social assistance debtors are a complex matter which required a little bit of time to reconcile. We've got teams in provinces that are working on that. We are hoping that by end of March, we will have reconciled all the 9 provinces, including the debtors that are managed by the FIU, which is the Special Investigating Unit of the NPA. We therefore got an extension from Treasury for us to disclose them only in March 2009. But unfortunately, because the Auditor General has to mention that in the audit report as a matter of emphasis, because it is a slight deviation from the normal generally recognized accounting practice, because you've got an item that you have not accounted for in the balance sheet in the normal practice. So it's just a formality that he has to mention that in the published financial statements. Otherwise, it's the only issue that came up as an emphasis of matter in the 7-8 financial statements.
Would that include carried over contracts of outside suppliers or service providers, your paymasters and the like?
No, all those things were sorted out.
Oh.
These are all other liabilities and assets. This is only the social assistance debtors, which is money that we overpaid to social grant beneficiaries. We're currently busy having teams. In fact, we also engage in Treasury. I had met with them yesterday. We will be meeting the Accountant General on the 28th, just also to sort out, you know, principles and policy issues around how this thing will be managed in this current financial year as we close the year in March.
So is that the area where there's also provision for ministerial pardon? Is that the case of situations where people who were not eligible actually received payment or received access payment over and above what they're eligible for, etc.?
Yes.
Are those the cases?
Those are the cases,
about?
Yes.
All right. Because the thing about ministerial pardon, I don't know how it is applied and what principles inform who gets the pardon. Who doesn't? Well, the Act actually does the principle. But so that's part of that whole exercise as well.
Yes, Chairperson.
All right. Is that where your story ends?
That's where my story ends.
What is the next story?
The next story is Comprehensive Social Security Check, but I think I've got a debt to repay. Actually, maybe just to revisit some of the earlier slides around strategic objectives.
Yeah, I think you would satisfy my earlier gripe with international priorities without a clear elaboration on our national priorities as well. And I thought there's actually a slide that had been prepared specifically on that subject, actually.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I think just to what I'll talk about is, I did speak about the strategic priorities at the beginning of the presentation. What I'd like to do is just to illustrate how these find expression through programs. And if one looks at the kind of programs, program one is administration, so I'm not going to talk about that much. But program two, which is comprehensive social security, then begins to speak about our social assistance obligations, which is issues about the national imperatives. It also looks at developing policies around a comprehensive social security system and also around policies around retirement reform. So those national priorities then find expression under that program. Program three, which is policy development, review, and implementation support for welfare services, which is a long way of just saying welfare services, begins to deal with key issues that mirror some of the things that we do in the international arena, but essentially under the financial year in question deals with issues of HIV and AIDS prevention programs, substance abuse programming, services for older persons, services for children, disability. Also included within that is victim empowerment and crime prevention, a family policy and family strengthening policies. So when we talk about vulnerability and dealing with vulnerability, these are the programs that deal with it under welfare services. So those national priorities find expression under program under Program 3. Program 4, which is community development, essentially then begins to look at the priorities around community strengthening, building self-reliance, and the program that we're taking forward are essentially sustainable development and also our own small contribution to developing human capital at community level. So those are the key priorities that we take forward through our programs. Program 5 essentially begins to look at what are the governance structures and strategic issues that underpin all of that. So, Chair, I hope that is to some extent satisfied the bit. They will be amplified as the programs present their own areas.
All right. I understand that tea is ready, and I'm sure we've all been looking forward to it. So shall we have a short break of 10 minutes and then proceed to deal with comprehensive social security?
I'm not going to entertain questions.
Sorry?
We're not going to have questions or discussions on the budget.
Do we want to engage before comprehensive social security?
I think so.
Hello?
Chair, I would agree. I think as we do the different presentations, the sections, it would be easier if we do the questions and finish them off, then move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I think this was more an overview.
Yeah, but Chair, you got your turn to ask your question, nobody else.
Yeah. No, I did indicate that points of exigency are allowed. So I'm not reserving that privilege to the Chair only.
Right.
But yeah, I'll limit my interjection.
Chair, you are only asking the leading question.
Hello?
You are only asking the department the leading question.
Yeah, because I know the members will be asking the critical
questions
later. So I'm reserving that task to yourselves. All right, let's have our tea, and then we'll come back and see how we proceed.
Chairperson, mine, first of all, I want to congratulate the department for trying to address all the concerns raised by the Auditor General. However, Chairperson, I just want to find out, because most of the serious concerns raised by the Auditor General was the understanding of conditional grants received by provinces. Now that they have taken over all the problems from the provinces, how did they address the question of no formal documented and approved program change, control standard and procedure, and again no user account management procedure, and again no independent monitoring of the mainframe security, lastly no formal disaster recovery plan. Thank you, Chairperson.
All right, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. I also want to congratulate the department on obtaining a unqualified audit report, audit report from the general. We know that the department gets the biggest chunk of the national budget, so it's quite an achievement to get a good audit report. But, Chair, it's a pity that we couldn't have this document before I or before. So as the Minister of Finance usually say, we must follow the flow of the money. And we cannot ascertain where it comes from or where it's going to, even if it's an annual report of 0708. But the question I want to put to you is, the savings in the executive summary, mention was made of a saving of 37 million rand, 37.704 million rand. Now, how is it possible that the department can make a saving? You can term it underspending, yes, but not the saving. The other question I want to put to you, Chair, is that on page 4...
It's always been a controversial term, you know.
Yeah.
They don't spend money and then they spin like politicians do,
yeah,
and call it a saving.
Chair, on page 4 of the executive summary, it is said there, it reads that the individual grants were recommended to terminate, and that reached a total of 118,655 in total. Now, the question is, how many are, what is the balance of that people that should be terminated, and what are the main reasons why this money was allocated to them in the first place? On page 4 of the executive summary that I have in front of me. The other thing is, some explanation on this line on page, also on page 4 of the executive summary, the policy has created mechanisms to efficiently and speedily conclude annual performance appraisals. But yet, the operative word in this document is there is underspending due to the lack of personnel, etc., etc. So how does this compensate to each other, if I can put it like that? Chair, there's another question I want to put to the, whilst we are talking about it. The people in the community development section, they are... In my constituency, all over South Africa, there are a lot of people or persons unemployed. Yet their children pass matric now, and they cannot send their children to enroll at a tertiary institution. So my question is, before they can apply for the National Student Funds, they must first enroll as a student and pay their fees. The question is, if they don't have money, where can they get the money from? Is there, and you have this program of
social relief. Can we put that money aside for such kind of program, or people that cannot pay for those enrollment at the tertiary institution? Thank you, Chair.
In fact, the whole issue of social relief policy is an area which at some point I hope they will discuss. Remember last year there was a vote of additional funds of 500 million to beef up social relief. Now, that was to be rolled out, I think, before the end of the financial year, and I think we're going to need, as part of our oversight role, to understand how that is going, which how it's being dispersed. Is it cash? Is it food parcels? Is it school uniform? And where are we in regard to that? In fact, I had hoped that we'd get some kind of presentation, because it was one of the strategic interventions that were made recently. All right. Is that the full
yes.
stage of question?
No, thank you.
Anybody else for this round? In any case, I think it's a handful now. Can you proceed in responding?
Chairperson, we are a team. I will just try and get assistance from line managers. My duty is to give them the money they spend. And for their sins. Chair, the question that related to the termination of grants, perhaps we could maybe park it for tomorrow. I mean, for when we deal with SASA, because I'm not sure whether that includes temporal disability grants that were terminated, or it's only all the fraud cases that were identified and terminated. I don't want to go to that without being 100% sure. The 1 million for Planned Parenthood Association, Chairperson, that organization I'm aware that there was a process to engage with them in terms of the regulations of PFMA guidelines. We can't just transfer the money. There are certain protocols and formalities that need to be met. There was an engagement with them to develop a project plan and that kind of stuff. And that process, I think, took a little bit longer. And it was unfortunately started in the second part of the financial year, towards the end of the financial year. So it became clear to us that by end of March, the money won't be able to be paid. But already then, we had already applied for increase in transfer to Treasury, because, again, there's a process. If it was not in the initial main estimates, we must get Treasury to approve the increase in transfer. Again, it's a PFMA requirement. So once we realized that, then we asked them for a rollover, which fortunately they approved. So we were able to pay in the following year. But I think in future it shouldn't be a problem. Now that they are an organization that will continuously fund, we should be able to transfer. It was the third year of their funding, which caused this delay in terms of negotiation. The issues raised by the Auditor General, you recall in last year when we came to the committee, SASA gave a long explanation of what they are busy doing in terms of addressing the concerns of the Auditor General. Yes, you're right, there were issues relating to record management, which led to, in fact, what they call scope limitation, and the Auditor General qualified SASA for that. They embarked on a project where they reconstituted some of the documents that were not there, and also there's the MIS project, whereby they automated their record keeping. They scanned the documents, the warehouses now that they have for filing all the necessary beneficiary information. So that's why in 7-8, SASA got an unqualified audit report. So another thing was the issue of policies and procedures. Recall, when we established SASA, we gave them our own policies, and ask them to customize them for their own organization. So the auditor general will always want to find something finally approved by top management and signed off by the CEO. So because at the end of the financial year, there were drafts, there were still things negotiated by management, he regarded that those documents were then non-existent as at the time of the audit. So that was another qualification. So after the year end, the management approved those policies and procedures. So Auditor General was satisfied. With regard to conditional grants, yes, we no longer have conditional grants. I must say it was a challenge to deal with that, because if provinces, for instance, underspend or they don't report, it will always be something that's reported against the national department. But we no longer have conditional grants, so that was no longer a concern from the Auditor General. The disaster recovery plan, you recall the CIO informed the Auditor General, even at the time of the audit, that they are in a process working with SRITA in developing this disaster recovery plan. And unfortunately, at the time of the audit, again, it was not yet signed off and approved. So subsequently, then, it was approved. So the Auditor General was satisfied. On the savings, $37.04 million. Yes, we're saving understanding. The chair has said it all. Well, the amount that has been reported as underspending, I think in each of the programs we try to give an explanation, especially in the terms of filling of posts and also some of the projects that were delayed. And unfortunately, we just had a chat with the COO on this. Sometimes when you look at the saving, it's not necessarily meaning that the key deliverables maybe of the department have not been achieved. Yes, there might be some projects that could not take off. But in some instances, the project indeed have taken off, but the payments to suppliers will come in the new financial year. So as I said, it's always good to look at the savings and compare the commitments that were not settled at year end. You'll see then that work has started in some instances at an advanced stage. But we usually don't pay consultants until we have the final product. So we really...
It's not actually savings, it's underspending.
It's underspending, yes.
So we would eliminate the term savings.
It's underspending. Saving is usually when you change strategy and you deliberately, or you use efficiency gains to achieve the same objective but at a lesser cost.
Yeah.
Then it becomes a saving.
Yeah.
But if you have not spent what you should have spent, then it's underspending.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I've covered most of the left in the addition of the COO. The other policies.
No, I think the issue of efficiency gain is one that maybe needs to be explored again in future. Because at the moment, there's a disincentive for efficiency gain. Because what you measure against is more expenditure versus output.
Yeah.
And what we're trying to do is match this. For example, we in Program 5, we now have employed consultants full-time, people who actually work as consultants. So they're doing work that we'd normally pay consultants to do. So that efficiency gain isn't measured in a sense that that saving... We have to actually.
That would be the first to call it.
Yeah. And so it's, and you have to.
But any money that's supposed to go to a beneficiary and it doesn't can only be an under-expenditure.
Yeah, exactly.
If you cut out all the other players, then that's a saving in my vocabulary.
Yeah.
There's a question on enrollment fees.
Yeah.
And whether we can use enrollment fees. We are first looking at the stress for enrollment fees. Well, we're going to have a presentation on social security, which is going to include a discussion on social relief of the stress.
All right.
And maybe we can raise that issue there, because it is an issue about what you can actually use the social relief of the stress money for. And we've had that discussion internally as well. So maybe even tell them that his presentation, they can touch on those kind of issues. But we're going to have more in-depth discussion on whether we can or cannot use from a policy perspective that money for...
Including answering the question, has it then been solved whether social relief continues to be part of social security or migrates out of social security into the other area of possibly wealth and services? But, all right.
One more question on performance
appraisal. Before we go to the next round, let's finish the existing questions.
Yeah. Performance appraisal issue.
Yes, but I would like to understand the question better because it relates to understanding the lack of personnel and then the annual performance appraisal. So I didn't get the question clearly.
By the way, ask the question. Use your microphone.
I trust I understood. Thanks, Chair. I trust I understood the question correctly. Whether there's a link between us not being able to complete performance appraisals on time and some of the money saved as a result thereof.
To a certain extent, yes, Chairperson. There's a number of performance appraisals that could not be finalized in time. Had we processed them in time, we would have spent the money. Because it's not just potential cash bonuses, it's also pay progression in terms of awarding higher notches on salary ranges.
So I think it's going to be backdated or unfortunately people lose out in the process. What happens?
Chair, it's backdated. To the data the official qualified for the relevant performance incentive.
Motivate that workers who can deliver efficiently and effectively. All right. Yes, Mr. Klepper.
Yes, just the availability of the document so that we can follow the flow of the money as the Minister of Finance usually says.
Yeah.
We have the budget for 0708, but the expenditure, not the expenditure. So we can have this document and compare it to the original budget, and we can just make a thorough research of that. Thank you.
Pakani, you want to respond?
On the slides, if you look at each slide, the first second column will show you the final voted budget, which will be your final budget after the adjustment estimate. Then it says audited outcome. That audited outcome is actually what you spend against that budget.
Yeah.
Then that gives you your spend. Then if you follow the money, that is what you bought with it. When the programs present, then we need to look at the actual output, what actually was delivered in terms of that money spent. So that's why when we report on finances, we refer to the program and sub-program. Then you bear in mind that so much was spent. Then you look at what they actually achieved. You can see whether, in fact, there were efficiency gains or there was underspending and those kind of things.
The program that we've agreed on are going to create room for us to be able to get down to that. Are we going to be able to engage with the various line function areas then? How they have performed in terms of, and then link it to the expenditure.
We do have detailed report to the lowest level. The Excel spreadsheet. Either we can give it electronically or for up to end of March. Then it can show. Can see at what level of detail. Well, this is now at a high level, at a sub-program level, but it can go down to show you exactly what each program spent in detail. I'm not sure whether the committee would love to go that far.
That's what oversight entails, is being able to see the finer nooks and corners. This high-level input really is there to make us all feel good. And then that's it, you know. But you don't really see much, you know.
Yes, we can.
Look, we obviously would want to have access to whatever information that would enable us to do our work, which is oversight. It is a pity that the trend has been to set aside very little time to really engage with annual report. You can't do it realistically in a matter of a day and a half. You need a whole week or two to do justice to it. We'll see how best we handle it in the current context. But remember that what we're actually engaging with is that the annual report. Is that thick document?
No, NDA.
Oh, is that the NDA? Which one is the department one? That's what we're really engaging with. So people should actually be having copies of it and going through stuff and be able to ask questions, specific questions in respect of specific things in that book. All right. You are still responding to...
I'm not going to assist here on that question as well. On this book, if you go to the part that is the financial statement, it got actually a fair detail of what was spent on, especially if you look at the report called Appropriation Statement. Because the Appropriation Statement gives details per program and sub-program up to a fair detailed amount of what amount was budgeted and spent. And if you look at the notes as well, even the transfer will give you the detail of which organization that money was transferred to and how much was that amount. Then you can be able to follow it through. It's quite detailed, actually. On goods and services, on page 177, it gives a range of issues, advertising, what was spent on communication, computer services, driver's licenses, audit fees. It can give you a fair...
The other thing to mention is that over and above the department's annual report, obviously there is the story of the Auditor General's report, but also there is the story of the Public Service Commission report. And I think we need to reach a point where we're able to collate and make sense of the flow of information between the three key instruments in doing our own oversight exercise in this regard. But anyway, are you satisfied with the response to your question?
Yes.
Let me first check if they've answered all the questions before I go to the next round. Yeah?
I think Eugene mentioned the link between expenditure and performance management, but I think we think it's not worthy to actually mention to the committee that we've restructured the way we do performance management, which is normally with something we'd only report in the next financial year, but it's useful to actually talk about it now because it's a corrective measure that we've put in place, which has significantly wiped out all the backlog on performance management. So we've got a centralized performance management system to fast track the backlog and to become more current with performance management. And that system is beginning to work very well. I think it's one of the few centralized performance management systems in place at the moment. I mean, it's working.
Yeah. All right, we're going to the next round of questions. The first person I have is Hoshi Muramuchi.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question, I want clarity from the department. Chairperson, my first question with regard to the pension. I have come across the situation where Chairperson, a husband has been working somewhere and then he got pension. And then when the wife goes qualified for old age grant, according to the regulation, SASSA does not want to assist because they are saying your husband is getting a pension. I just want to get the clarity from the department, Chairperson. The second question with regard to a qualified person, Chairperson, who qualifies for old age grant chairperson in 2007. Because according to his ID, he was born in June. I accompanied this person in December. Now they say he must wait for another, the following June, so that he can go and apply, even if he qualifies chairperson. I just want clarity from the department. Why are they doing that? So, lastly, chairperson.
How old is this person now?
He qualified for grant, for old age grant in 2007, chairperson. But the problem is a question of, they are saying if you are born in June, you cannot come and apply in August. You must wait for another June, coming June.
No, what is that?
That's why I want clarity from them.
On the day that you reach the required age, on the hour that you reach the required age of that
time. Please allow me to finish my question, Chairperson.
And I was just saying,
yes,
that look, it sounds very, very strange. So I think you may need, because they'll need details as to which office this was. They'll need to give the details of this person that was applying, so that it is investigated, because clearly that is wrong. It may be an isolated official who is doing something which is wrong, which is illegal. So you may need to, after the meeting, or at an opportune time, pull together the information and hand it over directly to Sandra to evaluate it and see what went wrong.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Lastly, Chairperson, it's the question of a grandmother who is staying with the grandchild, two grandchild of her daughter, who went to Johannesburg to go and work. But the grandmother does not have the details of the whereabouts of his daughter.
Oh, the mother, yeah.
Yes, and then...
Given to give a grant.
Yes, grant. No, the children are getting grant.
Oh, okay.
But when the old lady is requesting for old age grant, they say, no, already you are getting money on behalf of your grandchild.
No,
and also, you cannot qualify for the food parcel. Thank you, Chairperson.
That's excellent oversight work, because really we must look out for this kind of things. I mean, it may well be that out there are officials who do not understand the law or are simply being truant and depriving people of their fundamental rights. So I think as public representatives, we should be on the alert for such situations and make sure that people access their benefits. So even there, I think it will be critical for us to get the details of that person and have them forwarded to the department, you know. Because that is not, in any case, a grant for herself. It's a grant for the children. You know, it's a different story altogether. So it may be a problem of interpretation of the law with that particular official or that office. And we wouldn't want a situation where there's widespread misinterpretations of that kind. It would be travesty of justice. But, any other questions? This is the second round. Anybody who wants to raise any issue? All right. Do you want to respond?
The questions that you asked, some of them I think we can deal with when we talk to the issue of comprehensive social security, because there's policy issues, for example, on SRD, social relief of distress, it will rise again. Around, for example, what does the law say about when SRD, social relief of distress, is seen as a grant, and what does it say about people accessing two forms of grants? So those are the questions that, from a policy perspective, we develop and
Yeah, in fact, some of the issues relate to the new set of regulations that will be in relation. There was an issue that relates to
few regulations, I think, so we may need to look at that. Yeah, but let's reserve some of the stuff around Social Security till when we get to Social Security. All right. So some of the issues, Hoshi, when we get to the presentation of Social Security,
okay,
we are going to pursue them. All right. And maybe on that note, it's an indication that the desire, the appetite is ripe for Social Security, which is the next presentation. Can we proceed to deal with that?
Thank you, Chairperson and Honourable Members. I'll be doing the presentation on comprehensive Social Security, and I will be supported by my two very able and competent Chief Directors. And if you wish, Chair, let me introduce you to Mr. Thabo Rakoloti. He's the Chief Director. I can't refer to page numbers, but whether one has the earlier edition of the presentation or the later one, Social Security is covered. If people just page further than the...
Is this under social development sector priority performance review? Not that.
The comprehensive social security is written part B.
Part B.
On the
part
B. Okay.
So you give that one to
No, mine.
Presentation.
So
is it still coming?
Are you okay?
Yes, I'm okay.
Yes, now we're okay.
But
now we've got what we wanted.
Yes.
But they never courteously ask whether you've got a paper.
Yeah.
Humble like an idiot.
No, as long as Bishop Solo is
there.
Not ready yet.
No, she doesn't qualify.
I'm protesting because the paper.
All right, are we proceeding? Has everybody got the document except me?
Except you?
Yeah, I've got the small print, so I'm waiting for the bigger print.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Yeah, no,
you can.
Just before you go for
Mike,
before we start the process.
Yeah.
Just to because Andrea is not here. Please, the department must help us. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we can spend another 3 minutes about this issue. And she sometimes cries when the print that she's used to is not here. We appeal once more.
Yes, thank you, Jay.
All right, let's proceed. Mr. Jehoma, can you lead us?
Thanks. Let me continue where I left off. I said I was going to introduce the Chief Director for Social Assistance, Mr. Thabo Rakoloti, and Ms. Brenda Kudwani, the Chief Director for Social Insurance. I'm sure for members who will come back in the next term of Parliament, we'll see much more of them and hear more from them. Chair,
they are very lucky, you may not be there.
Yeah. the report focuses on the performance in respect of comprehensive social security, and although the appeals part of the work is separated from the policy making, there's also a presentation on it, and we'll be guided by the House on whether we should do the social security policy section and then deal with questions and then deal with appeals as a separate part, because it's a different area of work, and it will allow the committee to hone in better on the issues related to it.
No, I think let's deal with comprehensive social security first, and deal with the other aspects which are confined to social assistance per se as a separate discussion.
Right. Okay, by way of introduction then, and this is the next page, we know that following the Taylor Committee of Inquiry's report and recommendations to government, Cabinet adopted a three-pillar social protection framework for the purpose of social security. These three pillars are the social assistance, or the non-contributory support to the poor, paid for from the general revenue, and then pillar two.
Is there something? Can all other mics be off? Let's make sure they are off.
The echo.
Why? Is it the setting?
It's not mine.
That's not a cell phone. It's the setting of the phone.
It's a bit loud. Yeah.
It was made too loud.
The second pillar is the pillar of social insurance, where for those who can afford, contribute to social security in a system that ensures social solidarity for contingencies such as unemployment, sickness, disability, etc. And then the third pillar deals with voluntary contributions for benefits over and above pillar two contributions. Our presentation will in the main deal with, of course, social assistance and social insurance. Following the sort of restructuring of the department, and this is the next slide, after we shifted grant administration out of the national department, the social assistance function was restructured into three parts, one dealing with children and family benefits, and then old age and disability benefits, and social relief, and for those they're all driven by directors. In respect of social insurance, this was an entirely new chief director. This chief director deals with retirement reforms, and unfortunately it's not part of the notes there. And then employment assistance, where we look at how we link social security and employment. And then thirdly, social insurance functions located in other departments, where our role is in the main supporting, be it health insurance, unemployment insurance, road accident funds, and compensation for injuries on duty and diseases. We now turn to the social assistance component specifically, and as I've indicated here, we deal with benefits targeted at children, youth, and family. During the course of 2007, we commissioned a number of studies to investigate the feasibility of further extension of the child support grant beyond the age of 14. We investigated issues of youth benefits, and then toyed with the debate around whether we should be, instead of focusing on individuals, should be having a family benefit or individual benefits such as prescribed by the Constitution that everyone is entitled. In the main, Chair and members, these studies were more looking at the situational analysis of these categories as well as international benchmarks. These studies translated into high-level policy recommendations for comprehensive services to children up to the age of 18, a policy on protection for the youth, and then a draft policy on income for families.
I think this system has been tuned too high, so they need to reduce the who controls the system. Where are they? I think the whole system has been turned up, and that's where the problem is.
In your voice. Okay.
Yes. Okay. Better. Thanks, Chair. In addition, Chair, and it's not captured there, but it's captured in the report, and I think it's worth noting. In the context of the debate around the poverty measure for South Africa, we commissioned a study in that respect as well. We also partnered with UNICEF, that is the children's arm of the UN, to investigate the impact of social security policies on children. And here in particular, we looked at the challenges that children face in accessing the system, and that report came out during the course of last year, but was initiated in the year under review. The study also investigated the impact of failed social insurance policies, such as our current pension system, the Guardians Fund, and Providence Fund, and how, where they fail, to what extent they fail children. And finally, following, of course, the debates which you again raised earlier, Chair, we looked at the attitudes of South Africans towards social assistance in partnership with the Human Sciences Research Council. Under the area of old age and disability, we did during the year 2007-2008 approve, or Cabinet approved, a new definition for disability and also the new harmonized assessment tool. And during the course of that year, we finalized piloting these tools in several areas of the country to see to what extent they are effective. Also during the course of that year, we costed the implications of the age equalization because of a litigation brought against the department in that respect. We had in 2006 completed a review, and I'm going to the next page, of the targeting mechanisms used for social grants, the means test and the values of the grants, with a view to see whether they need to be changed. And of course, during 2007, this report was published. And of course, as we suspected, the recommendations were that because of the non-raising of the means test, especially when it comes to children's grants, many people were excluded as their income increased, but the grant thresholds were not raised. The outcome of this was that the regulations, or the development of the regulations, were informed, and of course it subsequently led to the adjustments of the threshold in the means test in a very significant fashion. Although
for information's sake, just share with us as to what the means tests are currently in terms of actual amounts. This public representative will be going back to their constituencies, and people will be coming and complaining that the department is refusing to give us a grant.
Yeah, I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Thabo, to, I'm sure you can remember the numbers better than I do.
Thanks, Chair. The means test for the child support grant was increased from, say, 1,100 to 2,300 per month. That is 2,300 per month.
300.
Exactly. But what's going to happen is that we have a formula that automatically adjusts as the grant value increases. This year, if the grant value becomes 240 or 250 rands per month, the means test will then be 2,500, and so it's going to be 10 times the value of the grant. Similar to the care dependency grant, because last year there were changes made or adjustments, in-year adjustments made. Probably the means test for the care dependency grant will be 960 times 10. And so that will probably work at around close to 115 or so per year. And for the old age grant, because it has changed, but initially it was 9,400. And so because of the changes in the grant amount during October, the minister is also going to change. And so that's how they're going to calculate that.
So approximately 10,000 rands a month would disqualify you for a care dependency grant. 960 times 10. So approximately 10,000 rands worth of income is needed to disqualify you from the care dependency grant.
Yes, yes. Last year, the means test, before the changes, it was 9,400 per month. No, I'm saying 9,400 per month. No, it was nine. Remember, it's 10 times the value of the grant. And so if the grant value is 940, you times it by 10. And so that becomes 9,400.
That's why I was giving the round figure of 10,000.
Roughly 10,000. Because it was increased from 4,000 per month. Initially, it was 4,000 per month, and so that increase.
I remember years ago it was 4,800,
and so if it's 10 times, it will probably work in the region of about 10,000 or so per month. And per annum, I think it was 112 at that time, but because of the changes, it has increased again, and so that's how it's being applied. And for the old age, for
can
the
I
old
just to get everybody on board. The care dependency grant is a grant that is available to children who are so severely disabled, and this is layman's language, so don't quote me, who are so severely disabled that they need 24-hour care. So basically you have a situation where a parent, for example, in some instances has to quit their job to look after this child. In some instances, it would not be the parent himself, but say a foster parent. So this is the means, but whose means is tested? Is it the child's means,
The caregiver?
The caregiver.
All right. Yes.
And so, of course, there will also be changes in terms of the means test for adult grants, your old age, and your disability, because the amount also changed in the value, the grant values. And so I think the last time we checked, it was for, if you are a single person, it was in the region of about 2,300 rand per month, or 27,000 or so per year. And so because of the change in the grant value, that's also going
in to any case, all of this is written in the regulation.
It's in the regulation.
So you can always look at the regulations and read for yourself what they tell you.
Right?
Okay, so that is the care dependency grant. Can you just quickly tell us of the rest? We're still on means test.
For the disability, the old age, and the war veterans, because it's a similar means test, initially before the changes in the grant amount, it was in the region of about 27,000. That is, if you were earning something like 2,300 or less a month, therefore you will begin to also qualify for the old age or disability and the war veterans.
So, 2,300 rands a month would disqualify you from getting an old age grant or a disability grant. And that money could either be coming from another source of social security, like a private pension or provident fund, or purely out of earnings from income generating activity, including employment. I think at that juncture, the earlier question that Hoshi raised becomes relevant. And that was the question of to what extent does the income of the spouse have a role in computing the minutes.
Yeah.
Let's say if my wife was employed as a chief director in government and has this hefty pension to retire to, and I was never employed, so I don't have any source of income. Does the fact of my wife's good pension completely disqualify me from getting anything?
Yes.
I know at some point the family income used to be taken into account.
Yeah.
Is that still the policy or has it changed?
Yes, Chairperson. If you are a family, we'll definitely look at the income also of the spouse, and then we'll combine that, and then it gets divided by half to see if that is within the means test threshold itself. And so if it's higher than the means test threshold, therefore that person will not necessarily qualify. If it do, they were not part of, you know, or they never benefited from any other form of income, but as a result of the income of the spouse, then they will then be disqualified. And so that income of the partner is also taken into consideration, but then it gets divided into two to see what's the total, and then when you divide it by half, to what amount do you get to?
Yeah.
And that might probably be the reason why in that case.
Can I just say that as far as my memory serves, that's been the system that we inherited even before 1994.
Mm.
But this has been one of the vexed issues that have been the subject of contestation over time, including the debate around whether you actually need a means test for the old age grant at all, given the number of, the percentage of old people that qualify, which is quite very high. So you're using the means test to exclude a small percentage of that population. How far has that debate gone?
Chairperson, during the course of last year, we engaged National Treasury, particularly looking at also trying to universalize the old age and the disability, those adult grants to see if we can universalize. And I think the approach that we have then taken was to also begin, in the absence of getting that being agreed, is to ensure that at least gradually we can raise the means test itself, because it's also a complex means test. It has something like the scaling factors and so on. You'll remember it will be 0.5B times 3A and so on. But as you raise those scaling factors, it also increases the threshold, and so more people will then be able to qualify. And I think probably as we begin to discuss with National Treasury, probably this month around some of the changes in the regulations, that is something that we'll also bring on the table. But also take into consideration the vision that what we want to do is to universalize the old age pension. But in the absence of getting there, we'll gradually increase the means test itself. And so those discussions are currently taking place.
Coach, you want to follow up on this issue?
Yes, Chairperson.
Yes.
Chairperson, this question of means test is not user-friendly to person who married according to customary marriage, Chairperson. If I've got six wives and all of them are working, so I must be disadvantaged because they are earning salary. Maybe I want to marry another two wives.
Especially relevant when it comes to traditional institutions.
Yeah.
But my understanding is that it works, the underlying principle is this, that the person whose income is taken into account there is a person who by law has a duty of support So there should be an element of a reciprocal duty of support between the two parties. And as you may be aware, under our family law, those that may not be doing it already, and those ladies who have husbands are not obliging, there is a legal duty of support between parent, between husband and wife, in the same way as there is a duty of support between parent and child. So you can actually take your husband to court for leaving you high and dry and enjoying the luxury of the shebeen without providing some money for support for doing the cooking at home. So it is based on that assumption. But I think the contestation is that is the theory of the law. The reality is that people find themselves, suffering because they have no pension to fall back to, and to rely on a spouse, discharging their duty of support, is not a reliable way of approaching this issue to ensure that they are covered and protected. So I think maybe in a sense, this is to convey, if we are allowed to lobby government as a portfolio committee, to convey our own sentiment that we would want to urge that government, seriously review some of these policies around ministers in order to especially cater for those that end up falling out of the system as a result. And that would include the very important point that Hoshi raises of having several spouses. Mr. Fiat, so you
yes,
want to also make a point?
Yeah, I just want to be practical about this, the amount that the Honourable presenter mentioned, 2,300, the mean states for the war veterans. So, a practical
account. That would be per person. So
per person, that's
combined
a person.
Would be
2,600.
Yeah.
A single person.
Yeah.
So, the two of them will then the mean space test for both of them will be 4,600. So, that's the question. Now, from when will that be effective?
I thought that was already effective with effect
from
August last year.
August last
year. When the new regulations were published.
And the other question is, how often do you revise or review this means test? On a yearly basis?
The theory is that every year, the actual computation of the amount of the grant is reviewed. All right, that's why the Minister of Finance, in his budget speech, will always make this announcement of the increase.
Yeah,
and then they get implemented at a specific date. Now, maybe one needs to just check: is the minister linked to the amount of the grant, or is it formulated separately? Because then it becomes static. It means that it will depend on whether there is another round of amendment to the regulations, because the regulations don't get amended every year. The minister simply publishes in the Gazette to say that which Regulation X refers to has now been increased to this amount, which is the actual grant amount that you get. But let's get the experts to clarify those issues.
In the main, the review looked at two elements of the means test. One was whether the increment, which was happening on an annual basis during the budget submission, whether that increment had been sufficient to ensure that the value of the benefit is not eroded by inflation.
Yeah.
And then secondly, whether the thresholds itself were moving. Now, we will recall that there were only the two grants, at least three of them, but two are important for the purpose of this discussion, where the thresholds did not change, and that's in the case of the child support grant, which was introduced in 1997 at
a level of 800 rand in an urban area and 1100 in a... That never changed until this study was completed. And then secondly, it looked at, of course, the child support grant and the care dependency grant. At another level, the study also looked at whether the increment as they occurred over the years through the budget was sufficient to maintain the grants at the level so that the inflation did not erode it. And it was found because in the old age, in the case of the old age benefit and disability benefit, there were increments but not sufficient. In the case of the child support grant and foster care grant, those increments were sufficient to maintain it at least at the level or to ensure that the value has not eroded as a result of inflation. Going forward, we now have for the child support grant as well as the care dependency grant formulas that are self-adjustable, which is what my colleague mentioned, that every year when there's an increase, then you multiply the amount of the grant or the value by 10, and in that way the threshold also shifts up.
That has not been applied in relation to the old age grant.
What it does, in the case of the old age grant, as the increment is made every year, the threshold also increases.
By what percentage? Certainly
not. Of course, it depends on the value of the increment, which we know 5 years ago the increment was 20 rand, it moved to 30 rand, 40 rand. At a percentage level, I can't really work out. But it's sufficient that it may, that it's at least above inflation.
No, but the issue is that in the case of the child support grant, you get 2,200 quadrant, 10 times that, which is the threshold for the minister, gives you 2,000. So if you're going to increase the amount, say double it over time to 400, then the min test will probably be in the region of 8,000. Now, in the case of the old age grant, it's currently at about 900 and something, 60. So. Now that, vis-a-vis the min test of 2,300, would give you something like just over 2 times the value of the grant. So, but it goes further than that. It says, realistically speaking, have you looked at what 2,300 rand really means for a retired person? Can it possibly be sufficient for that person to survive on? Have we done a study of what our average living standard of living is? What measure have we used to arrive at a conclusion that 2,300 is sufficient? I can take an argument that says for now it's an issue of affordability. But if it's an issue of saying we have arrived at a conclusion that 2,300 rand is adequate for somebody at that age to survive on, and that includes urban and rural, I can tell you in Joburg, bachelor flats don't go for anything less than three grand or that. But people are saying, I mean, and where is the debate around, that was the earlier question also, where is the debate around the complete removal of the ministers for that particular grant especially?
Chair, no, we have not looked at at what the grant can buy or cannot buy. The values of the grant as they currently stand, except for the child support grant, is more informed by historical factors. There's never been an evaluation. But I think 2 points are worth noting. One is that at its current value and with the increment that we'll see in February would raise the income support for the elderly so close to the minimum wage. In fact, it's been increasing faster than the minimum wage has been increasing that it may create the disincentive. And although we do not support the wider debate around perverse incentive, but it will begin to create some disincentive for work at the margin. So the value of the grant are fairly high.
Which grant are we talking about?
I'm here speaking about the old age grant because you asked whether the current old age grant.
But Hammer, disincentive for work in relation to old age grant, what does that mean? Doesn't the whole purpose of having a grant at that stage, or a pension for that matter, based on the assumption that society says it's time for you to legitimately go sit at home and not work because you have reached your legitimate right to retire. Isn't that the rationale? Because maybe we'll get to know more and understand the discourse around perverse incentive creating dependency.
I'm not sure whether the objective anywhere in the world is around whether we say you have now made your contribution and therefore you must legitimately sit at home. The oldest grants, especially of a non-contributory nature, the objective there was poverty alleviation amongst the elderly. That's been the objective or the aim of it, and never around whether it should. Which is why I must say I've been saying tongue in cheek the issue around the disincentive, and I also again say it's at the margin. But the most important point to remember is that, in fact, the oldest grant value is relatively high if compared to the average wage income. And then the other point to make is we know that based on the poverty measures that's been, or the debate around the poverty measures, that in all respects of all studies done around the poverty measure, the oldest grant value is higher than all of the proposals made around the poverty measure. Chair. I'm slightly worried that I may not be able to go through the other points. And some of these issues require a fair amount of discussion
and debate. No, the idea is not to exhaust issues that will obviously need a whole workshop for.
Yeah.
But obviously these are issues that members encounter in the course of doing constituency work. People come to us because we're desperate and they want some kind of relief. So for us, those are the more important issues to discuss. That's why we take our time on that. It's not so much some of the other philosophical issues. But, Mr. Dengo?
I think that it's an important point to raise as far as the portfolio committee. The issue of universalism is not a technical issue. It's a political issue. And I think what we're responding to from its very technical policy framework, which circumscribes what we can do. But the issue of universalism is really something that needs to be, as a portfolio committee, maybe engage at a strategic level. Because what it does is, once you have no universalism, then it brings issues of means testing, then it brings in issues of poverty levels. The debates around those, too, are not technical as much as political. So in many ways, our policy approach has been sort of circumscribed by those kind of issues.
I understand this. We're not saying that it's up to the department to review some of this. We know that you still have to battle with Treasury and probably the whole of government to get some of these policy issues through. Obviously, a social development will always lobby for more and better benefits to our constituency, and it's only fair for us to be expected to do that. But obviously the decision does not lie with social development alone. It involves a much broader, issue of policy and macroeconomics and all those issues. But from our point of view, any gains that we can make
for our constituency, we'll always push for that. So, that's where we move from. All right. You can proceed.
Thanks, Chair. Although the document that you refers to other social policy development issues, they are not peripheral. The reason why we've highlighted them because they have resulted almost in immediate implementation and service delivery. And these policy issues relate to the AT equalization, in which case I've indicated earlier we had started the calculations in 2006, and in 2007 we had the debate, which then resulted in subsequent implementation during the course of last year. Again, the same goes for the child support grant. During the after the outcome of the research itself, it was raised in the interministerial committee and resulted in the further extension, which kicked in during the course of this month. And then we had a claim from refugees for access to social grants, specifically disability grants. That plan was submitted to Cabinet during the course of 2007-08 and was brought into the regulations last year. The same goes for relief of distress for refugees. At the beginning, or at least towards the end of 2007-2008, we saw the escalation in food and fuel prices, which had a global impact, and here at home, Cabinet has established an interministerial special committee where proposals were made for the adjustments as well as how to deal with this through social relief of distress, which I will turn to later. My colleague, the CFO, has substantially touched on the transfers to SASA as well as the administration, so I'll just pick out some high-level points. Is that the beneficiary numbers have grown to a significant 12.5 million, but it's worth noting, especially when you're going to challenge us later on, Chair, about the issue of sustainability, that that number seems to be tapering off in spite of the upward adjustment of the means test. We are seeing significant numbers of people on an annual basis being removed of the system because of the integrity measures we've brought in, and our view is that this creates significant space for future extension of the social security system while we maintain expenditure of about 3.5 to 4% within our gross domestic product. We can
the international norm, or where does that norm, by the way, come from?
Well, it's not the norm. It's been the trend in South Africa over the last 5-6 years. We've been wavering between 3.2 up to 3.5, which actually never happened, but projected to happen. But there are countries that it's not only always the size of a chair, but also the comprehensiveness of it. So although it's a country, it's quite significant. But it's not as comprehensive as Mauritius and Seychelles would have. It's again worth noteworthy to note that Denmark was in its developing country stage at that same level of about 3.6, but then it had a poverty rate of 5% compared to South Africa, where our poverty is at close on 47%. Nevertheless, again,
reverting area, everything is relative to everything.
I was going to say, quite often these things are informed by political choices that countries make. Again, as a country, unlike many other countries, we've been in the last 2-3 years in a situation where we don't borrow to fund it. We're able to fund it. Chair, during the beginning phase of the SASA transfer, we generated service delivery assurance report on the effectiveness and efficiency of social security spending. Regrettably, that part we're not continuing anymore, and it would be useful for this committee to ask SASA about the details of that. We continue to roll out the registry at least during 2007-2008 of the management information system to Social Security, but that task has been transferred to SASA. we as Social Security provide some support to the finance section for the monthly transfers of funds and expenditure reports in respect of SASSA. And then periodically we undertake evaluations of service delivery. That's the issue, Chair, on social assistance, where the presentation has covered some new policy proposals as well as ongoing maintenance. In the area of social insurance, during the course of 2006, as this committee will recall, we reviewed the pension system and made some far-reaching recommendations for reforms. During the course of 2007, we released four feasibility studies on these reforms, one touching on the aspect we've alluded to earlier on removing the means test to the old age grant. We also made a proposal around the design of an appropriate retirement benefit system of a mandatory nature for South Africa. We explored options for providing insurance cover for post-retirement arrangements, and we did work on the accreditation of retirement insurance fund providers. In addition to that, but not noted there, well, it is there, my apology, not on your notes, but on the presentation on the screen, we developed a conceptual framework for an integrated and coherent institutional arrangement for a social security system. We undertook micro-simulation modeling, that is essentially throwing numbers into a system to see if we were to universalize the grant system, introduce a new retirement system, what would be the fiscal and financial implications for the country. And that is a report that we, for the most part, discussed in-house. Of course, the availability of these studies contributed to the establishment of an interministerial committee by Cabinet, led by the Minister of Finance, on social security reforms. As part of our work, we continue to make input into that process, and that relates mostly to retirement reform. In addition to that, under the Directorate of Employment Assistance, we developed and submitted to Cabinet a conceptual framework on linking grant and employment activation, which was a study conducted in the main by Oxford University to look at international trends, and that led to more work, which outcomes will only be done in this financial year. Finally, Chair, it's important to note that we continue as a department contribute to international social security development through the International Social Security Association, of which our Director General sits on the Executive Committee of that body. I now turn, Chair, to the Social Relief Fund, which in essence is part of social assistance.
Before you move on, I had asked earlier a question relating to this migration of people off migration requests, but being able to move people out of social assistance and so-called dependency over time. Was there a dedicated project on that? Was it just a study? Was it just a discourse? Where is that issue? Moving them into sustainable livelihoods and winning them off the grant.
Yeah. Chair, we prefer to, and there is a dedicated project and it's part of the government's program of action, that we link social assistance to economic activity. Of course, there are different angles to how it's interpreted. Some will argue it's for the purpose of avoiding dependency. And we've realized to take such an approach would be, to a large extent, a futile exercise, because we provide the social assistance for children, for people with disabilities, and for people who can no longer be employed as a result of old age. The project nevertheless looked at two approaches of linking, on the one hand, people who are the caregivers of these children, potentially to employment where they're unemployed. We must bear in mind that the means test is such that many of them are gainfully employed in any case, but a large number are unemployed. And the project then looked at it in the context of a workfare program and or a welfare-to-work program. The other angle of that same study is how do we expand the current social assistance program and then link people to economic activity, especially those that are employable, and that's ongoing work in our investigation into a youth benefit and the benefit for adults who are unemployable. Some would like to refer to it as a basic income grant. In the context of people who are caregivers and who are unemployed, we know many of them are in the context of workfare, able to access the expanded public work. But that program in its nature is limited, where people go into the system. The findings indicate that they often do not get training. They are temporarily employed, but they find themselves unemployed within months after entering it, or after a year for the most. Yes. The other angle from which we've looked at it is around welfare to work. How do we get them into the system and then link them up with employment? But again, the point made by my colleague Zain Dango is very valid. We can't expect the social security system to be responsible for both social security and try and generate economic activity. This has to come from those departments responsible for our macroeconomic policy as well as the labor market policy. What we seek to do is how do we provide the benefit in a case management situation where you give the benefit and then help people to overcome the barriers or the constraints, be they of a training, skills development nature, or just pure knowledge about access to employment. And this work is ongoing. There are two things we don't have, right? One is, other than employment, where it's not been available in sufficient numbers, is just this mismatch between skills and what is in the labor market. Again, that's the responsibility of our educational system and skills development institutions. And we've got to work with them. The other challenge is institutional arrangements, where a welfare to work or linking grants with economic activity exists. It's often within one institution, such as the UK, such as in many states in America, and also in Australia, where the institution that gives the benefit also links people to work. But in South Africa, that responsibility belongs to the Department of Labor. And we will recall that the Presidential Review Commission already in 1997 recommended that the social assistance institution and the Labor Department need to merge. And in that context, we will make a document available in the very near future to provide for options around the institutional arrangement. Coming to the dependency, I don't want to get involved in that debate, Chair, because it's quite a discourse, but let me say two things. One is, if we argue that the 8 million people who are unemployed in South Africa should not be given income support because they become dependent, then it's important to remember that they are dependent in any case on other poor people. So as a society, we may want to think around the values that we maintain around how do we deal with the poor. Do we allow them to eke out a living and bear the consequences of poor investments in human development and the costs that go with it? And part of that cost is, if the grant is aimed at a child of 200 and the parent is unemployed, then the parent share that benefit, which means the child has a poorer diet. And in South Africa, we know 6.1% of our population goes to bed at least two or three nights hungry every month. And if the child gets a lower, poorer nutritional value, we know that it leads to stunted growth, and hungry people can hardly be productive either when they learn or when they work. So for us, the debate perhaps around dependency is not always held in a manner where we discuss the various rational elements about the choices we make, but rather about a concern that we have about the poor from an angle of, quite often the worry is more affordability, and our views about the poor and dependency is quite often used as a bit of a smokescreen, I dare say.
Can I just add one point that, there's a number of facets to it. The one is just the impact of high levels of unemployment on the real possibility of achieving this on a mass scale.
Yeah.
I mean, if there is shortage of jobs, the employers out there are going to prioritize your fit, highly skilled, et cetera, et cetera. We, for example, I was part of a project called MOLT, Medlin's Organization for Disabled and Culturally, back in, we established in 93. And our approach was for every disabled person that we are able to put into a puzzle shop or some telephone or something that, you know, the small business activity, and they're able to earn sufficient income that disqualifies them in terms of a means test to continue to receive the grant, then the department should be willing to also inject some kind of subsidy into the scheme, because it's very costly to empower somebody, especially to be, first of all, not that many of us are born entrepreneurs, so we love to work for somebody else. But two, to actually start and run a sustainable business in that environment of uncertainty can be a huge challenge. But that was just the one thing. We realized it's a very difficult area. You are limited in terms of numbers, talking about scale, you know, a critical mass issue. Then there was the issue of welfare, employment, like your, what did you call, sheltered workshops and protective workshops, which were being run at a very high cost. But, you know, the incomes were such that people continued to get the grants anyway. But the advantage was that people were engaged in some kind of activity that sometimes also impacts a certain level of skills and so on. But I do not want to really open up a detailed discourse around this. But I think at some point we may need to look at, in fact, even in the context of social development, we may need to hear from the disability arm, for example, of the department as to where are the programs relating to economic empowerment of disabled people within the department itself, because that impacts, even if it's in a small way, on how you then gradually are able to take off some of the people of the grant because they're economically self-sustaining. But Mr. Bengo, you wanted to comment on this one?
Exactly. It's an important point to raise, because what it does is, when we engage in the issue of dependency and reliability, what is, in the last 2 years, we've been forced to engage in studies to disprove what is essentially anecdotal evidence. So there's not been one study that has come out to prove dependency, but there's been a number of studies that actually disprove the fact that you have dependency, which detracts from our ability to move on some of the key issues, because now we're spending money and energy around areas which are really anecdotal. And in the social cluster, for example, and the economic cluster, what this has done, and this is where I think the Portfolio Committee engaging with is important, it's actually taken away the lead from other departments around what are you doing about the issue of job creation and employment at local level.
Why should it be social development job to win people off the ground when we have a labor department, trade industry, and the other?
So it's almost like a dual accountability. We got to meet our constitutional requirements in terms of paying people, but at the same time we must think about how do we actually get them off the fence, which is actually from a strategic perspective something that we need to resolve. Because we're sitting with a mandate at the social cluster level, which is a management at the ministerial level, where we're arguing these issues that we keep on coming back to something that at a technical level we've seen isn't working. But at a broader level, there's still an expectation. And I think, Chair, you're being diplomatic, because people do use the term off-ramping. And as, you know, it's something that we preferred value-adding. So we're saying that we would prefer to add value to the grants we put into households and communities through additional services. But the moment we see it as an either-or thing, we actually get into those poverty traps where you have projects that don't pay people a significant amount of money, notwithstanding the input costs. And we eventually get to the point that people have to choose between grants or working in projects, whereas in fact, if they do both, the livelihood ability to be
enhanced. We're going to have to step off this one because we still have other areas to cover on the issue of comprehensive social security. I'll come to Hoshi now. Mm-hmm. But I think, and you would have noticed with the substance abuse approach as a committee, is that if we're given a task, for example, come up with a comprehensive law on substance abuse, we don't only call the Department of Social Development. If we're convinced that there's a problem with drugs at school, we don't wait for permission to call the Department of Education to engage with them directly. So I think the next committee in the next parliament is going to have to take these issues up and actually call all those other departments here and not talk to them via this department. Talk to them directly and let them explain what role are they going to play or are they playing to assist with that whole off-ramping, whatever it's called, so that it's not seen as an exclusive burden that resides with social development simply because social development is the lead department of social security, because it's fundamentally not a social security issue. But Hoshi, you wanted to follow up on something.
Yes, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson. Under social insurance, there is a sentence, Chairperson, where they are saying accreditation of retirement insurance provider. But, Chairperson, there is no provision where they are going to monitor the very same people they have accredited. In many cases, instances, Chairperson, people get frustrated when they are going to lay a claim. It's then that they experience very serious issues, Chairperson, where they will also go to the lawyers to do the claim on their behalf, and then they are going to claim 10% on top of the very same normal procedure because there is no monitoring.
In our constituencies, we've always encountered those
kind of cases. People come to our offices with this kind of
complaint. Yes.
Now, that's very true.
Yes.
The issue of consumer protection in our existing retirement system, and even if you create a new system, are we making sure that some of those issues are not going to be a legacy that's carried into the new retirement public insurance system that we are? But you're going to now go into this area in a more focused manner. All right. I think he'll touch on that if he proceeds. Can you proceed with the rest of your presentation? We've actually significantly derailed you.
I have, in fact, covered the social assistance aspect as well as social insurance. We just thought, given your interest on social relief, we'll conclude with that. So there's no more detail in respect of social insurance that I'm going to touch on. Suffice it to say that...
Just to touch on the issue of the comprehensive social security as it relates to reform of the retirement system, which has the one component which is the introduction of the new public insurance scheme on the one hand, and on the other, where are we in terms of the current challenges, which may not necessarily be your responsibility, but probably Treasury, be it regulation, be it consolidation of the private retirement system.
That's correct, Chair. You recall that we have in our review said that for all intents and purposes, we actually don't have a pension system properly construed. The current system is one where people are not mandated by law to contribute, but they exist out of bargaining council arrangements and private decisions. And that part, as you correctly indicate, indicated, is regulated by the Pension Funds Act, which is the purview of the National Treasury. Our recommendation was for a government-sponsored retirement fund that mandate every South African who are able to contribute, and it's in the context of that that we then recommended that we should allow service providers to also deliver that system through the government-provided system, and that those whom we allow should be accredited. We cannot, where government mandate people to contribute, allow them to, and I've often called them sharks in their presence, who deliver poor services, expensive services, and give the consumer thereof a hard time. So our accreditation recommendation, exactly, Chair, exactly. So our recommendation for accreditation was not in respect of the private funds, but we agree that better protection is required for the private regime, and we trust that the Treasury will draw on these recommendations, which we've put into a well-researched document. Where is the process? Maybe not further than we were when we submitted the recommendations, Chair. I'm going to have to be honest here. The vested interest in this area, in this country, is so big that we've been discussing retirement reform in 1997. The Taylor Committee, where you were a member of, Chair, discussed it. We had in 2004 a document by the Treasury that said everything in this country is hunky-dory. We don't need to change it, but we know we've got serious problems. We've made recommendations in 2006. Since then, we've worked in an interdepartmental task team together, and we agreed that the process is complex and detailed, but we would have wanted to make a lot more progress by now, and we're not making it at the pace that we should. It's important to bear in mind that such a new system will not cost the government any real money, unlike social assistance, because it will be paid for from contributions that people make. But we think there is a lack of will to reform the system. But hopefully, Chair, going forward, it will pick up some speed. I think that's all I can say in so far as I...
I think I'm going to allow you to proceed to social relief. But I want to make this one last point. And that is the fact that in similar vein as I indicated earlier with the substance abuse thing, where we've taken a resolve as a committee that we will engage any government department who we think has a role to play in addressing the problem of substance abuse. Social development is a lead department in this whole discourse around comprehensive social security. And I don't think as a portfolio committee we should shy away from engaging Treasury to say, you know, that as long as any person who is supposed to benefit from a retirement fund is not benefiting, for whatever reason, be it consumer protection issues, be it general efficiency issues relating to that system, that person is going to end up on our lap. Either they're going to have to be dealt with in terms of our old age grant or disability grant or some other grant, and if a grant can't help, the social relief can't help, social workers are going to have to deal with that person who is in destitute in circumstances where, if the other system worked better, that person should have been, you know, one of our clients. So I don't think that we should adopt an attitude that says certain things belong at the purview of somebody else and we're not going to tamper. We should be able to say, to the extent that the other system results in certain people being failed by that system and therefore ending up with us, we have an interest in ensuring that those gaps are actually plugged. That's why I believe and strongly support the idea of social development, you know, poking its nose into discourses around reform of the retirement system and related issues that may not necessarily be squarely within our mandate or our purview. And I think that's the approach. It's a similar thing around the other issue of dependency and migrating people to become economically independent. We should be engaging labor and saying that many disabled people have employment equity, you know. Are we succeeding in getting more and more disabled people employed in the open labor market? What are the barriers, you know? And advocating, I know there is an office in the presidency that deals with disability, but at social development, we are social development, and we should concern ourselves with general issues of social exclusion and actually advocate for people to become socially included. So I'm just saying, I don't think that we should be shying away. Even if we pushed aside, we should continue to push our way in into those discourses, and not just in the discourse, but in the actual process of formulating policy. But I'll leave it at that. Unless you have any final remarks on that, you can then proceed to deal with social relief. And I also respond to some of the other questions.
No, Chair, on that note, I think I owe this committee an apology. I have been of the view that this committee has been shying away from the debate. It was quite a public debate, and not once did this committee say, let us talk about it. I also don't think it's a treasury purview, it's an issue of social security, and we can't have the National Treasury being a referee and player when it comes to social policy. So I thank you for making those remarks, Chair. In respect of the social relief of distress funds, during the course of 2007, we reviewed the existing legislation as well as the policy. And I must indicate, Chair, it provided us with two opportunities. One is, we've been of the view that social leave of distress should be delivered by provinces. But that doesn't mean it's not part of social security. Any intervention by government by means of in-kind or cash transfer is social security. We just think it ought to be located at the level of provinces. Secondly, it provides us with an opportunity to review these provisions which were introduced in 1992 before the democratic changes, and therefore it may well be time for Parliament to engage and look at how we can provide relief of distress for people not covered by the main social assistance grants. We've appointed experts to consolidate the provisions that's currently in the Fundraising Act, again, an act that goes back to 1978, as well as with the new Social Assistance Act, so that there's one of them. The notes say we dissolved the board, but it's not quite correct. The board's term came to an end, and we decided not to renew it as a result of issues that the CFO alluded to, was that one is the Disaster Management Act puts the responsibility for recommending the declaration of a disaster with the DPLG. Prior to that, social development, the Minister for Social Development made that recommendation to the President. Secondly, in the earlier years, 1994 to 2001, given provinces' fiscal capacity, they always relied on the national department to intervene when there was a disaster. In the last 2 to 3 years, provinces have not been asking us this money, and therefore we decided not to appoint a board or to recommend to the minister the appointment of a board. In the interim, in the context of the escalating food prices during the course of last year, as well as the ongoing financial crisis globally, which impacts on South Africans as well, 500 million rand was made available in the adjustment estimate for social relief of distress, and the allocations per province is noted for members to look at. How are we going to deal with it? The money, in fact, goes to SASSA as a transfer from social development, of which we know there's about 8 different provisions, amongst others, where people still await a grant, or where the breadwinner is in an institution, or where the breadwinner is medically unfit. But for the most part, those provisions aren't being used widely, but more to where people suffer hardship or undue hardship or unwarranted tough situations where they can't afford to feed themselves or their children. In the distribution of this money, which was made available last year, the provinces were in the main target children who have fallen off the CSG from 14 to 18. We have been working with civil society, traditional leaders, and other institutions, religious and otherwise, to identify needy people. We also will be looking at providing support to people who have, in the meantime, appealed against the decision of SASSA and or where their disability grants are rejected. The benefits will be in cash as well as in kind, although for the purpose of distribution, we're looking at in-kind benefits in the main, here school uniforms and food being typical examples. To answer the member's question earlier on, whether one could give it to a child who wants to go to university but there's no bursary, I think although explicitly the relief provisions do not provide for it, we'd like to interpret it more widely and say that if the family must use whatever money they have for registration of a student at school and thereby forfeit their right to food and other basic services, which will then cause hardship, we believe in that way, one may as well say, here's money for registration at school or at university, with the operative word being the potential undue hardship that a family may suffer. And in a similar vein,
I think we need a lot of certainty around some of these issues.
Yeah.
I had an exact case, like several of those cases last week, with the rush to catch up with the registration at universities, amounts of anything from 1,600 to 5,000-6,000 being required, and a lot of people not being able to afford to pay for that. Well, I don't know what this scholarship program at the Department of Education's role is, where there's sufficient flexibility there to assist people to afford registration. But I'm just worried about a situation where we'll end up basically just taking over other people's mandate. If there is a scholarship program that's aimed at supporting learners at tertiary level, why should a critical aspect of that function, which is to support registration, and we all know you can't enter an institution without registration, how does it happen that that aspect is not covered? And why should then we use social relief from social development when it's a scholarship program?
Yeah.
I think we need to begin to engage with other departments and ask them, what are they doing about issues that clearly are challenges that confront them, as opposed to us? If it's about food security, I mean, we should be engaging agriculture and asking, you know, those kind of questions. I mean, are we doing that? And what is their response? Hoshi wanted a follow-up.
Yes. Chairperson, my follow-up, Chairperson, with regard to the question raised by my colleague, the Department of Social Development, they are 100% correct, Chairperson. That question falls under the category of education, not social development. Thank you.
Mr. Skeppel?
No, I don't have a follow-up.
Honorable Sala?
No, Chair, I would agree with two things. But you see, the problem in this country is from which premise are we moving? And the kind of processes that are followed. The question of registration at school, it's part of a flawed system. And I think it should be understood from that context. First, the Department of Education does not make any provision for that aspect. No one takes it up with the department. But the issue is, the results are released at the beginning of the school year. Immediately after Christmas of New Year. Now the child doesn't know whether it's coming or going. And by then, parents have no money, even if. Now the context is, you are dealing with a community, a population, that is extremely poor.
Yeah.
We tend to temper that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
We talk of Canada, we talk of Australia. Those are communities, why they are poor. They have got a means of survival because the inequality is not as huge as it is in this country. And that is man-made. I agree with you, Chairperson, but I think this matter must be taken up sharply with the Department of Education. That one system, within their own system, as I'm sitting here, I don't know, how am I going to give my cleaner in my constituency office 1,600? I don't have. But you phoned me yesterday, and I've got a huge headache. I must go and borrow the money. No, she doesn't have. She's a cleaner. That child is not going to be registered. So. I think we have to look into this question of the college and the historical perspective of it. We seem to think that, look, this is a normal society, you know, comparative to Britain, France, and all the countries that are called. We don't do a proper research on this particular aspect. But that's my little comment. I'm affected, by the way. I'm sitting here not knowing what to do.
I'm sure all members would relate, if they've been to their constituency offices, to a whole lot of challenges around access to education, including this kind of, I mean, kids are excited to receive their matric results. Some have done so well, come from very poor backgrounds, and now they still have to crack their heads about whether they are going to spend a year at home doing nothing. Even if they perform so well in matric, I think we can't simply say it's an education matter. That's why I'm saying social development, one of your mandates is to concern yourself with issues of other people and other people's mandates. But all right, we've run out of time.
Okay.
Yeah. I wanted him to finish and allow us time to engage with the whole thing at once and take a whole host of questions.
Yeah, but seeing that we are there, Chair, can
all
I just put, Mr. Joma, just open the door slightly.
All right.
The question is, where should one apply if we need the money as soon as
you
possible?
You mean the social relief?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they must make some announcements about who in the province is to be approved.
The regional offices away.
Etc. Right. Question?
Chairperson, mine is similar to this one, but with regard to function delegated to provinces under the same social relief of stress care person. Here the department is clear under the proposed strategy, but when it comes to implementation in the provinces, provinces are not using same regulation. They are using secular. You go to KwaZulu-Natal, you find it difficult, differently. You go to Limpopo, you find, for argument's sake, Chairperson, in my area, you find social relief of stress says, out of the whole Sikukuniland, which consists of 65 million people, only 5 people can be assisted. Yes. Yes.
5 million.
Million.
The whole population of South Africa.
Yes. Thank you, Jay.
Okay. Right. It's still linked to social relief. Respond to the questions and then also use the opportunity to round off on that.
Yeah, Chair, probably in the first instance around the issue of people wanting to get into university and get scholarship, I think my colleague, Dr. Mabetwa's own experience around social workers will shed some light on some of these institutional challenges. But again, because we are aware of these challenges, in most countries there is the provision of a youth benefit that a combination of both from the educational system of bursary, but also income support for a young person to make that transition. So I would like to agree with the chair that it's not only an education issue, it's an issue of poverty, and we need to see how the social security system can support.
And how is that difficult,
well, the technical work we've done, chair, now belongs in the realm of politics. Let me put it that way. The recommendation is there.
We'll read the manifesto.
All right.
Okay.
Maybe I should say one thing to deal with the misleading information that came from the media. Our cost estimate, Chair, was going to be around 10 to 12 billion rand to introduce a youth benefit, and not what the Sunday Times has said, 30 billion rand on a wage subsidy. But essentially, the recommendations have been discussed within the department in the main. And also, we've done some work, as you will know, to consult other institutions around it. On the issue of where to apply, and yes, provinces do still interpret the regulations differently. To that extent, we held a special Heads of Social Development meeting last year to ensure that they developed a more common understanding. There's also a procedure manual, and I guess one of the constraints where members of parliament should tell local officers when they want to address insistence on a social worker's report. We've removed it from the regulations because it's onerous on social workers and given the lack of social workers. So any SASA employee or auxiliary social worker should be able to do that assessment. And members, if members look at the regulations, that benefit should be provided almost immediately. And we will continue to talk more to regional and provincial officers. Any office of SASA is there to provide the social relief of this space. And of course, the awareness will heighten now that the 500 million rand is in provinces. Unfortunately, they only got it during the adjustment estimates. They have, over the last 2 months, developed the implementation plan. And we know in the Western Cape and Gauteng, they already started implementing on a much larger scale during December, whereas the other provinces have been lagging behind. Brings us to the issue, yes, in addition, it's worth to mention that
I can say a lot of members during December were pestering me asking, where do we go to get this money?
Mm-hmm. And then you pestered me during the holiday.
Okay. Okay. Honorable Stoller, to make an urgent comment and then we'll come at
you. You see, I don't know. I know that I'm helpful. When I stand up everybody, you know, listens and look at me and forget what I'm saying, to say to say, your head fast. You know, going to these offices, probably I turn around and I become an animal and say, with due respect, let's talk about reality and the impact that these things have. I hear the presenter say, you know, talk more and all these things. I don't know when are they going to start talking. I've been in this parliament for the last 8 years. The same attitude, the same hopeless work ethic. In fact, I attempted to call a meeting with some of the officers. They're not interested. They don't know me. They don't care. That's the attitude that they show. And I'm not going to phone so anymore. So I'm not going to phone you anymore. This is my last term. I think I have some pension. you see, the point is, it's a lack of will or understanding what you talk about when you talk about poverty. You see, there's a mall in Sakane. That mall has just been built. People patronize it like no any other body of business because of Sakane. There's a mall next to the casino, which is empty. I don't go to the Sakane mall. I go to the empty mall because I get an immediate service. Now, it's a question of the poor subsidizing the rich. And that is, has been allowed structurally, and you don't think along that. Just my point is, you see, in this presentation, proposed strategy, it is said support from civil society to identify needy people. Now I don't know who I need clarity, because I am not civil society. Sometimes I think the counselor is the civil society, because more attention is paid to the counselor and the mayor. You know, if he comes there with a list of people, in fact, can I give you this? which was given to me by the people. Let me give you the whole newspaper. I can't go to my parents' house in Sakane. I can't socialize with people I socialize with in Tema and Tutuza. Because of that, they know I'm in parliament. They come to me. I don't even know how these things are brought out. So I need to have a clear understanding when we talk about support from civil society to identify needy people. Because, look, let me not use those words. But I know because she's a traditional leader, probably people go to him and she gives this information and provides the needy people. And I hope, of course, they don't end up like that, where they don't get answers. Nothing is explained. And they try to come to solo. Indeed, I decided not to, even if I need an extra car for my sister, I'll drive her, phone her, and ask her to bring the car, and ask my wife to take it back. Because the minute they see me, they all come running because of this program, or what you call it. Yeah, it's been very popular. I've seen, I've heard people shouting social relief. And interestingly, except for exception, I haven't seen this program in a constituency, and I'm not going to go to that office, because I'm tired of making enemies with people. I've got enough enemies. Thank you,
Koshi?
My chairperson, I'm happy to hear from the department that there are regulations. I just want to plead to, through you, Chair, to provide us with those regulations.
Yeah.
The regulations that were promulgated in August, didn't they also, were they social relief separate, or were they part of those?
No.
So they are contained in that.
We
didn't get a presentation of the draft regulations, and we considered them in what is that hotel? Diamond Hotel, and subsequently they were promulgated in August. But those that may not have access to the Gazette, I'm sure the department can always make copies available. Maybe they can provide them to the committee secretary for her to distribute to members in their pigeonhole.
Mm.
All right. Now, is there anything else critical as way into lunchtime that you would want to touch on in your final remarks before we
conclude our proceedings for the morning.
He's
going to respond to the issues raised, so as part of his surrounding.
Yes. Chair, I'm not going to go what is on your outline of the risk factors, but I think it's pretty much give members a sense, and I've just been given a copy of the article myself and agree that it's quite disconcerting that this happened. I must indicate that, you know, this year started when the minister had realized that things are not happening in provinces as they should. You know, a number of us have been deployed, myself included. I have been spending my time in the Eastern Cape. My colleague Zain in Northwest and the DG and the CEO are sent to KZN and Limpopo. So we're not saying that there aren't problems. We're aware of them. And we're trying to deal with them through task teams and people deployed from national. I think the only other request I can make to members is that where these issues happen, it helps to let us know so that we can target those officers and see what we can do to intervene. Chair, I'm going to close there probably just on one note, is that the new recommendations we've made for social assistance, be it a youth benefit and a caregiver's benefit, We argue that they are affordable and sustainable if introduced over a period of 5 to 6 years to ensure that everyone has social assistance if they are poor. From the point of view of sustainability, we'd like to note that it's sustainable insofar as we know that it's not going to put a significant liability on government exceeding a certain percentage of GDP. I think I will conclude with those comments and like to thank you for entertaining the social security section as you have done.
Obviously, to the sake of our language, it's really the bare marrow, or is that the English word? The bare bone of the matter. I mean, there's a lot that we could engage on in this, all these areas if time allowed. We're going to end here for now. Have lunch with, is it finger lunch again? Oh, it's 2009, a new year. Oh, excellent.
Sit down,
old assembly time. Shall we return at what's the time now?
Quarter past one.
Let's give you an extra 15 minutes. Let's come back at 2:15 and not a minute later.
All right.
So that you can do your private business as well.
Yes.
Let's go. Are you there?
Leave your documents. The room will be locked during lunch period. But take things that you're going to need.
Identification.
Okay.
The minister mentioned it in one of the interviews last year. We have never ever received the details because that's one of my main problems. People don't have IDs.
Yeah.
And they say, well, what can we do?
Alternative means.
Alternative means. Sasa needs or can accept alternative means. So can homeless.
That's the one who's standing by.
But there's. You merely mentioned this thing to the
minister.
I have already set a note for you. I want all the details. I don't just want everything here.
Yeah.
I want it in my thing. I can show people.
Yeah.
You see, you're dealing with some people at that level. Then you look dumb because you don't know any better.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Because you don't have all the information.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's nothing worse than taking a test than you are.
And then it can be the wrong test, right?
Liable to be the wrong test.
I don't know.